We'll start today's BPR with Chuck Todd of Meet the Press, who said we've been witnessing the greatest presidential scandal involving a foreign government since Iran-Contra. He'll elaborate. Then we'll talk with you about what the president says is the real story. Leaks. You're troubled by them? You're cheering? And what message are they sending? Then it's an hour of Governor Charlie Baker in studio to answer your questions and ours. How did the tea survive the storm? And I'm guessing there may be a little Donald Trump talk.
Harvard scholar and author Carolyn Light on her new book, Stand Your Ground, explaining America's love affair with lethal self-defense. Boston Globe columnist Shirley Young on the upcoming women's strike, part two, and today's immigration strike, both to protest President Trump. Then we'll open the lines and ask you about our already traffic jammed and overdeveloped South Boston Seaport District. Our question, when you visit the Boston waterfront, is it too much to ask that you actually get to see the water?
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Eastern Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hi, Marjorie. So, well, I mean, I'm not going to waste the time. Well, Watergate is the political scandal some people are comparing the Michael Flynn mess to. Chuck Todd says it's the biggest presidential scandal involving a foreign government since this.
I take full responsibility for my own actions and for those of my administration. As angry as I may be about activities undertaken without my knowledge, I am still accountable for those activities.
That, of course, was Ronald Reagan in 1987 apologizing for the Iran-Contra affair. The question is, could President Trump ever get to this moment of public accountability? Chuck Todd joins us on the line to talk about this and other political headlines. Chuck, of course, is the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. That's Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Good morning, Chuck Todd.
Well, good morning, Jim and Marjorie.
Good morning, Chuck Todd. I want to say I understand you're cleaning up there on Meet the Press. Good for you. Congratulations. So,
Thank you.
So why do you compare it to Iran-Contra? Why do you think it's this, I believe you called it a class 5 political hurricane? Why is it this big?
I think it's this big because it is not isolated, right? And that where it is all a part of this larger issue of Russia. Right. What role did Russia play? And did anybody in Trump's orbit facilitate and help Russia out to meddle in the election? Did they do it on their own or did they have help? And that is why in isolation, you wouldn't say Flynn leaving is as big of a potential issue since Iran-Contra. But because it involves a foreign government, that's the reason why he was fired. And because for some reason, he covered up about it. And now you have, you know, and then now you have a Trump White House that is waking the echoes of Nixon and Watergate. Now they want to hire and bring in an outsider to provide oversight into the intelligence agencies. Well, you only do that if you're trying to intimidate those intelligence agencies. They're acting like they're fearing the truth. The more he complains about leaks, it means he fears the truth.
You know,
it's a rough place to be. Right
speaking now. Of truth, you know, in the wake of the Puzder withdrawal, in great part because the Republican senators said you got to pull this thing, votes against a number of these cabinet nominations, a growing number of Republicans seem to want to know the answer to the question you and others are who knew what and when did they know it? That is becoming a bipartisan call to a degree, is it not?
I think if you had a White House that was functional and not in the middle of this, you know, Game of Thrones situation that they're in right now, combined with the Flynn situation, I think you have a bunch of Senate Republicans that are not—they don't fear the White House. And if you don't fear the White House in when you're not even a month from inauguration, and you don't fear the White House, and you're a member of that. The same party as the White House, that's a big problem for the White House. So that's why there is no Labor Secretary right now. You know, if you had a functional White House, the ones that weren't crazy about him would have felt pressure, well, I'll go along, you know, I don't want to stand in the way. Mm-hmm. These guys are, you know, about to do tax reform. They're not about to do anything right now. They're still in the, they're going to hold a campaign rally on Saturday? What campaign?
Yeah.
I'm just befuddled.
Chuck Todd, you mentioned, you referred to the outside guy, this Steven Feinberg, this billionaire ally of Trump, coming in to look over these intelligence agencies. This is unusual, isn't it? I mean, does this happen regularly, that some outside person comes in and does like in-depth look at them and what they're doing?
Well, what you're doing is you're essentially saying the two people that he appointed to the major intel appointment, Mike Pompeo, the CIA, and Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence. What the president is saying when he brings in an outsider is that he doesn't trust those two people. Well, what was the point? If you want to reform the intelligence agency, you do it via the appointment process. You do it via the way the checks and balances. You let the Senate weigh in. And so by doing this, it feels like nothing more than intimidation of the intel agencies. Put it this way, that's how the intel agencies are going to view this.
You know, speaking of the intel agencies, I have to say, if I was old enough, I have to be candid and say I would have predicted Dewey over Truman, so my track record is not extraordinarily good. However, when I read that comment a couple of months ago where the president-elect, I think at the time, likened the intelligence agencies to the Nazis, I said, there's going to be payback time. So now that he's saying the real story is the leaks, and there are leaks from somewhere, is it payback time from his own intelligence community? Is it some people in the intelligence community who are troubled by the direction the administration's going and they want to send a message to the public? What do you think this is all about, Chuck Todd?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with Mike Flynn, the individual, in a number of ways. You had a whole bunch of people in the intel community that did contribute to forcing Flynn out of his job at DNI. And he was forced out due to the fact that there were many people that thought he was a bit conspiratorial. There were many people that thought he wasn't very trusting of others. If his thesis didn't win the day, then he denounced others. And Mike Flynn, as an advisor to then-candidate Donald Trump, for a year has been telling Donald Trump, hey, the intel community is politicized. I know. That's why I was fired. Well, it isn't why he was fired, but he believes he was fired over politics. So he has spent a year, essentially, in the president's ear, daily almost, saying, don't trust the intel agency. Mm-hmm. So guess what? Now President Trump doesn't trust the intel agency. So I really believe this all revolves around Flynn. And that distrust of Flynn by intel makes these intel folks skeptical of the president.
We're talking to Chuck Todd. He's the moderator of Meet the Press. Let's talk for a bit about James Comey. As everybody knows, a couple of weeks before the election, Comey announced that the FBI was investigating some possible still unreleased emails from Hillary Clinton on another laptop involving Anthony Weiner, the disgraced congressman. But at the same time, we now know that he was remaining silent about these allegations of the contact between Trump's team and the Russian government.
And Harry Reid was talking about him, saying they're explosive information that he should be releasing.
Yes, they weren't just allegations, but concrete evidence of contact, frequent and ongoing, as several people have reported, including the Washington Post. So how does he justify this? It just seems so, I mean, not good for the goose, not good for the gander kind of deal.
I'll tell you how he justifies it. I'll let you be the arbiter about whether he's right or not. He justifies it this way. And number one, he felt as if under oath in front of a congressional committee, he made it clear that if there were any developments, he would let Congress know when it came to the Hillary Clinton situation. So he believes that is what he was doing. People that are close to Comey say the guy is a Boy Scout to the nth degree, and that sometimes, you know, he keeps his word to the point where it'll undermine himself. But let's set that aside. That is what he will tell you. That is what he firmly believes. And anybody that tells you that, hey, he made this under oath, this commitment to a congressional committee that he would let them know if there was more information, and in his mind, this was the equivalent of that. On the Russia stuff, he will argue that it is policy of the FBI not to comment on investigations when you're in the middle of them. And then he would argue that the reason he commented on the Clinton one and not the other one is that the Clinton investigation at the time was concluded when he went before and testified on Capitol Hill. Now, should he have ever done the original, whatever you want to call that, news conference when he announced his findings, saying he's not bringing charges, but she was careless? That is the Pandora's box that opened up. But then he would tell you this, Marjorie. He wouldn't have been in that position had Loretta Lynch and Bill Clinton not have been on that airplane and seen.
Okay.
Okay. I know.
Okay.
Chuck Todd, I want to play for a minute a bit of your conversation with Bernie Sanders on Sunday on Meet the Press. Here's obviously Sanders and Chuck. Here it is.
We have a president who is delusional in many respects, a pathological liar. Somebody who is trying to divide us
words.
Up.
Could you work? Can you work with
a strong word?
Can you work with a pathological liar?
Well, it makes life very difficult, not just for me. And I don't mean, you know, I know it is very harsh, but I think that's the truth. When somebody goes before you and the American people say 3 to 5 million people voted illegally in the last election, nobody believes that. There is not the scintilla of evidence. What would you call that remark? It's a lie. It's a delusion.
So, Chuck, that comes at about the time that Senator Al Franken is saying that a couple of his unnamed Republican colleagues in the Senate have questioned the mental stability, health, whatever, of the President of the United States. This is pretty touchy territory for people like you, is it not, to go into something, even though apparently a lot of people are talking about it?
Look, it is. You know, the question is, what is... This goes to the issue that had been brought up during the campaign by many people, and it was why so many Republicans didn't support Trump, prominent ones, and that is the temperament question. Does he have the temperament for the job? I thought it was a strong thing to say, and it is, how do you accept ever working with somebody that you believe is a pathological liar, right? And that was why I asked. I understand why he may believe that, but when you go and say that, you can't take that back. This goes to what the president has, which is this massive credibility problem. I think the White House has a huge credibility problem, whether it's the staff, whether it's the president himself. I mean, my gosh, he even has a credibility problem with his own vice president. Since they kept him out of the loop. So this is accumulating. I think if trying to psychoanalyze him, you know, people have been trying to do that with Donald Trump since the 80s. I would just say it's a well-worn path, and it doesn't usually get you anywhere.
You know, on that note, you mentioned about Mike Pence being kept out of the loop. I had a retired general who was a Ryan last night on television with me, who's a former Russian attaché. And he suggested the only reason he could come up with why Pence would have been out of the loop is if Donald Trump was in the loop on Flynn's connections and conversations with that Russian ambassador during the transition period. Does that sound plausible to you?
It's a very plausible explanation. That's the problem the president has. The most plausible explanation of keeping Pence out of the loop is what you just said.
You know,
and that is why I don't understand. Look, if I were the White House, even if I thought I was guilty, I would be wanting to at least put up the facade that I wanted a real investigation.
You know, Chuck Todd, obviously the president has had some problems in these early days, but millions of people voted for him. He won. He's the president of the United States. What do you hear from Trump supporters about how he can turn this around, get back to the jobs issue that was so compelling to so many voters who, you know, don't have $5 at the end of the week? What can he do?
Well, I think a couple things that he's done that is smart is, you know, every day he holds some sort of jobs event. Every day he's with some titan of industry somewhere who's making a promise of new jobs. So I do think many of the supporters that voted for him on that single issue, are you going to put me back to work? Are you going to give me a better job? They see that. They look at the rest of it, and I think some of them view it as white noise. But look, I've had some anecdotal discussions with some Trump supporters who are just sort of don't understand why he's not more confident. Like that, that is a, you know, look, there are diehard Trump supporters. Those will be the ones that are going to show up at the campaign rally. But you have about another third of his supporters that are divided between people that voted for him because they just couldn't bring themselves to vote for Clinton, and people that sort of were reliable Republicans that weren't big fans of his. And that's the crowd he's losing right now, because these are the ones that are, they're Republicans because they believe Republicans manage things better than Democrats. I say right. this as the child of one of them. My dad, my late father used to say, I want Democrats to come up with the ideas and Republicans to manage them. Because he always, in his mind, thought, well, it's the business guys or the Republicans, and they'll run it more efficiently. And when a Republican administration is in, shows signs of incompetency and mismanagement, they lose there's this group of Republicans, they lose quick, and it's that group.
Hey, Chuck, before you go, very quickly, is there any truth to the rumor that you're applying for a job at the Christian Broadcasting Network so you can get to ask a question of Donald Trump?
You know, it's funny. I think we should all come up with, like, new, weird news organizations that sound like conservative Trump organizations or something. And it's like, I work for MakeAmericaALittleBitBetter.com. You know? You me.
I like it.
Chuck,
like
great
it.
To talk to you. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much, Chuck Todd. Right, and again, congratulations. Chuck Todd is the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. That's Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Thanks again, Chuck. Coming up, we are opening up the lines and asking you about leaks. Do they help or hurt democracy? That is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Mark Regan. To leak or not to leak? That's the question, to which Donald Trump actually has two answers.
WikiLeaks. I love WikiLeaks.
That was candidate Trump in October. Here's how the president, as in Trump, felt about leaks just yesterday.
People are trying to cover up for a terrible loss that the Democrats had under Hillary Clinton. I think it's very, very unfair what's happened to General Flynn, the way he was treated, and the documents and papers that were illegally, I stress that, illegally leaked. Very, very unfair.
Even though the Republicans and the president had no problems with leaks that dampened Hillary Clinton's campaign today, they're singing a different tune. Here's the House chair, a Republican, of the Intelligence Committee.
You know, right now, my biggest concern that I have is that General Flynn, who's an American citizen, had his phone call tapped and recorded. And then put into a transcript and leaked to the media. I can imagine that any American should be concerned about this that's out there.
So we're opening up the lines asking you, where are you in the issue of leaks at 877-301-8970? Do you think they're good for democracy? Do you think they hurt? Is it ridiculous in this day and age to think that anything is confidential or classified or unlikely to be leaked? 877-301-8970. I mean, the answer to this obviously is in the eye of the beholder, as we just learned here. Donald Trump loved leaks when they're hurting Hillary Clinton. He hates leaks when it's hurting him. And I don't think he's that atypical. I mean, I have a standard that I hope is a little bit more impartial. I like leaks when they rebut lies being told to the American people by government officials. Like when, I will never forget this day, we played the sound before, when United States Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon, a former legal services lawyer, I should say, asked James Clapper, who was director of national intelligence, I guess it was, is there any intelligence data being gathered on Americans? And I'm paraphrasing, and his answer was no. It was not a lie. It was an outright lie. It was an abject lie, which is one of the reasons I'm more sympathetic to a sort of splitting the baby with Edward Snowden, because were it not for Snowden, we wouldn't have known they were being lied to. Same with Mike Pence. I don't see any evidence that Pence lied intentionally, but he lied to the American people because of General Flynn apparently lying to him. By the way, as I said to Chuck Todd, that retired United States general on my show last night said the only explanation for that, in his estimation, is that Donald Trump was part of that discussion, not on the discussion, but was involved with General Flynn in the decision to have that discussion. So the answer is, for me, I always am in support. If you're being lied to and there's no transparency, then if leaks are how we get the truth, so be it. Beyond that, it's a little murkier kind of question.
Well, leaks are as old as mud, for heaven's sakes. There wouldn't be any. I mean,
there wouldn't be any news without leaks.
And an example, I think, when I was a young reporter, if you didn't have people leaking to you from within government agencies about terrible things that went on there, how would you think we would find out about these terrible stories about children being abused and
dying?
You
wrote a lot of them, actually.
I did when I was young, and those were all people that were, for the most part, social workers who were courageous enough, at the risk of losing their job because they're fireable offenses, obviously, and they're illegal because there's confidentiality issues there too, to do the right thing because they were so upset by the malfeasance in their government agency. So if there were no leaks, there would not have been Watergate. We had leaks in the Bush administration. We all remember they leaked all this classified stuff so we could be talked into going to the Iraq war. That didn't turn out too well, did it? And Obama, there were leaks all during the Obama administration. There's been leaks going on forever. So, I mean, to say that the issue here is the leaks, then why don't we say, when were there no leaks? I mean, leaks are kind of a constant.
Well, in the spirit of fairness here, I agree with you completely. It's a misdirection play to say the real issue is leaks. The real issue is what happened. That's what the real issue is. But this is no different than the behavior of Hillary Clinton during the campaign when her people would not respond to the content of WikiLeaks leaks,
right,
other than to say exactly
they're
the same
illegal
thing. This is illegally leaked information.
Yep,
they illegally hacked into our email when the content to me, and by the way, they are right, and so is Donald Trump, I believe he is, in terms of the illegality. But when the underlying information is out there and you're not going to rebut it, then the answer is maybe you got to respond to the content of the leaks.
And Obama,
as well,
by the way, was no big friend of the press. He went after
one of the worst ever in most people's
mind. One of the worst
mind.
Ever, very secretive. He went after a lot of whistleblowers, and he went after a lot of leakers and was very punitive about it. So, and by the way, while it is illegal to leak classified information, again, it does happen all the time. And mostly, though, it's not classified information, it's information that could cause you to get fired. So the people...
Confidential. That's what Jeffrey Dubin was talking about last night.
And the people within the government that are willing to leak that are, I think, unless they're doing it for some nefarious purpose, and they could be, which is why you have to vet these leaks. I mean, they may have an...
A reporter has to vet these leaks.
Yes, but when you have someone that's telling you about malfeasance in a government agency because they're concerned, I think that's a good thing, and that enables reporters to do the journalism they need to do to ferret out.
Well, that's the whistleblower versus traitor argument. The problem with your vetting, and then we'll get to the calls at 877-301-8970, vetting is an anachronism. Maybe the mainstream press is going to do vetting, but when you have right-wing websites, they're going to publish stuff that's damning to the left, and you have left-wing websites, they're going to publish stuff regardless of the risk that's damning to the right, vetting doesn't matter anymore. There's no vetting on the extreme. So, you know what I mean? I mean, 20 years ago, there was vetting. The New York Times would make a decision, the Boston Globe, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal.
Well, I think those newspapers are still making those
decisions.
Yes,
but it doesn't matter if they make those decisions. When who was the one that released the dossier? Was it not Daily Beast? Who released the dossier?
Oh, that was terrible.
Yeah.
It was the guy that used to run Politico. He went to,
I can't remember. Can you guys tell us who released the dossier a couple of weeks ago?
That was awful.
In the content of the dossier. But the point I'm trying to, BuzzFeed? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Thank you, BuzzFeed. But the point I'm trying to make is it doesn't matter that CNN responsibly did not report the content as long as there's always a BuzzFeed. So the point I'm trying to make is there's no such thing as real vetting anymore if everybody doesn't vet.
Well, there's always been these publications that put whatever was going on out there. I mean, the supermarket tabloids used to do it all the time. It's usually about people's affairs. Of course, 90% of the time the supermarket tabloids were right about the affairs. The mainstream press just ignored them. But I think that this has been a wonderful week for the Washington Post and the New York Times because they have both done great reporting to reveal shenanigans between the Trump people and Russia. We don't know the full extent of it.
The Trump administration is not saying that either story is unfounded, by the way. They're just talking about leaks.
So, I mean, I think – and I also think that you've got to be very careful, the Trump administration does, in being too harsh – I mean, he's bringing in this guy not supposed to investigate all these intelligence agencies.
The guy you're
agencies.
Talking to Chuck Todd about?
I don't know that that's – I don't know that you want to antagonize them anymore when you've already antagonized them.
877-301-8970. We're talking, obviously, about leaks, which Donald Trump said yesterday was the real – or in the day before, the real problem, even though he, quote, loved WikiLeaks when the leaks were damning to his opponent.
Cole from Boston. Hi, Cole.
Hello, Cole.
Thank you for taking my call.
Hi.
After the fall of the Berlin Wall, Tim Sebastian of the London Times discovered that Ted Kennedy was conspiring with Russian leaders against then-President Ronald Reagan, and millions of Democrats voted for the communist Bernie Sanders. So I'm a little... It's funny that...
Well, by the way, in light of the fact... I don't know if I may, Cole, if you... By calling Bernie Sanders a communist, it casts a little bit of doubt on your original allegation. So we'll check it out, and our team is looking at it right now. I'm not aware of it, but he is not a communist. He's a democratic socialist, and maybe you'd have a more interesting conversation if you stuck to the facts. Cole, thank you for the call.
Nor do I, but
we're going to check it, and as soon as our colleagues let us know, we'll let you guys know. Let's go to Kathy in Cambridge. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey.
Hi. One of the things that I wanted to comment on is a very interesting book by a former deputy director, I think, in the State Department for Counterintelligence. And the book is called Leaks, Spies, and Lies by Robert Booth. Fantastic Booth, a book, interesting guy. One of the things he talks about is how the leaks, as you have mentioned, go back to the administration of George Washington.
Right.
And in fact, they are well organized, that there's a kind of template for how leaks get leaked. And he also had a great acronym for, you know, he's obviously interested in counterintelligence, that the State Department is the place where foreign service from other countries really look for recruiting spies. And he had a great acronym called MICE, which was Money, Ideology, Compromise, and Ego. And a lot of people who are recruited are people who get into the State Department because they're concerned about bad behavior on the part of the United States and feel like maybe they can rectify it in some organization. But it's a great book. It's very, very dense with a lot of information.
Well, thank you for the book recommendation, Kathy. So are you in favor of leaks, Senator? That put you in favor of leaks or not in favor of leaks?
What it did is it did make me feel that they played a very important role.
I think they really do. I think that's how you get information.
Well, but you know, the flip side, I don't know if we're taking this too far in one direction. When governments are not transparent anymore, and I think that's a fair generalization to make, leaks are hugely important, but they can also put people in very vulnerable places at risk. So I guess the answer is there are leaks and there are leaks. And I assume, Kathy, even with your reading of that book, you'd agree with that, right?
Yes, and that is discussed in the book. And
great.
It's just a fantastic in-depth analysis of those subtleties. So
thanks.
Kathy, thank you very much. Obviously, you know, it was very upsetting to a lot of people, the original charges about the NSA guy, that he was leaking information that jeopardized American troops, American undercover agents, et cetera, and people that had been helping out our American troops. So you obviously don't want that to happen where people get outed and then they get retaliated against. So there's, you know, variation among them. But generally, in this situation, when you talk about finding out that, again, that there was something going on between the campaign of Donald Trump and the Russians, and obviously something going on with Michael Flynn and the Russians. I think that's something important for people to know.
John just emailed and said, I mischaracterized the Ron Wyden, James Clapper discussion, so let me read it to you verbatim. Ron Wyden, senator from Oregon. Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? Clapper, no, sir. Wyden, it does not? Clapper, not wittingly. There are cases where they could inadvertently perhaps collect, but not wittingly. And I think we know the facts, John, who emailed, is that that was as deceitful and dishonest as it could possibly be, which paved the way for Edward Snowden to correct the record. So I guess, you know, I guess my one uniform rule in this is when you're being lied to by people in power, then leaks, as you said, Marjorie, are the only avenue to facts, the truth. Kathy,
and
thanks
know,
for the call.
Where's another place that you find things out is courts and police. I mean, you have people leaking about things that are going on there as well.
Well, a lot of that's public record. Some of the great moments in Spotlight are where court documents that disappeared, where the lawyer was making it known to a Globe reporter where those documents might be found. And it really changed history in this part of the world, if not the whole world. In any case, 877-301-8970 is our number. We're talking about leaks, Donald Trump being for them before he was against them. We want to know where you are.
John in Gardner. Hi, John.
Hi, kids. How we doing?
Good.
Thanks. Great.
I'm glad you're getting to the heart of the problem. It's those Obama embeds in the administration and in the security forces that were left behind. You want to guess where I got those talking points?
I heard it too. Go ahead.
Where?
Fox News.
I didn't hear it from there. I heard it from some, I can't remember, some commentator last night. Actually on CNN. Some Republican commentator said that is the, that's the problem.
Ryan is saying it right now on CNN. The leaks need to be investigated.
Yeah. And by the way, can I be clear about this? Because I don't think we've been at all. I think the leaks need to be investigated too. But there are two issues, the underlying facts. What was the Russian connection between the Trump campaign, the Trump transition team, and Russia? And two, I think the leaks should be investigated. It appears that at least some people like Paul Ryan are saying the leaks are number one. Everything else is not even on the chart, which in our estimation is wrong. I'm sorry, John. Go ahead.
Jason Chaffetz is saying the same thing, basically, too. Did you guys go back and watch that press conference when he called on a reporter by calling her Katie?
Yes. He told her it was a nice question.
At the end. That was the woman from townhall.com, yeah.
Guess where she's a regular contributor, by the way.
Where's that?
Fox News.
Well, that's fine. The joke I made, which probably nobody understood, to Chuck Todd at the end, is the last two press conferences, one with the Prime Minister of Japan, one with the Prime Minister of Israel, the only questioners who have been called upon by the president, our president, are people from very conservative outlets, which to me is not a fair and balanced kind of thing.
One more thing real quick?
Sure.
I have a suggestion humbly for Emily to do a segment on Friday night.
Well, maybe you should tell her, but go ahead. What is it?
She did a thing on Joe Scarborough during the campaign.
Yeah.
She should do a thing on O'Reilly. You guys wonder why I watch O'Reilly every night or tape it.
Uh-huh.
Because he's talking to the heartland, and those people buy it. And all this is about is that the press is out to get Donald Trump and that blah, blah, blah. But he is such an apologist and explainer for Trump, it's unbelievable.
Why don't you send Emily an email, and if we remember, we'll pass it along. Cool. Thanks for the call. By the way, O'Reilly is the most watched cable news show virtually every ratings period. By a lot, actually.
I think it's important to point out that Trump voters and a lot of Republicans are with him. They view this all as once again, the media out to get him, and this is the fake news, and this is the fake media, and all that kind of stuff. When you look at Real Clear Politics, you look at the daily tracking polls about is the country going in the right direction? What are Trump's approval ratings? He's down mostly in 40% approval and up over 50% in disapproval, and the country's not going in the right direction. Those are mostly around in the 30s. So.
But you heard what Chuck Todd said in answer to your question. It's not just people out in the world. It's people in Congress who are uniformly on the Republican side behind him who now feel because his numbers are lower that they can stand up to him without risk. I mean, do you remember?
Those are not great numbers, is my point.
John King told us on Tuesday when he was with us, he didn't think Puzder was in trouble for a reason that made total sense at the time, is that Mitch McConnell was going to enforce discipline. And I assume what John would say if he was here today is the world fell apart since we spoke to him for Donald Trump with Flynn, the New York Times story, and the willingness of House and Senate Republicans to stand up to Donald Trump expanded exponentially, which is one of the reasons they made, I wouldn't say the demand, the request that Trump withdraw the Puzder nomination. And you know that yesterday Puzder withdrew his own nomination, assumedly at the request or at the demand or the urging of the President of the United States.
Okay, we are talking about leaks or not to leak. That is the question. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about leaks during the election. We saw how the DNC hacks influenced the outcome. Today we're seeing how they're affecting a fledgling presidency. Do you see people like Julian Assange and Edward Snowden as heroes? Do you see them as traitors? Are they what 21st century whistleblowers look like? If you think about some of the more consequential leaks, from the Pentagon Papers to Plamegate, remember we talked to her, the Valerie Plame thing. Were these good or bad for democracy? I think one of the most important things we've said so far, sadly, was by you, not me. They're here. The issue is how to deal with them. They're not stopping. And I would argue that while people are correctly troubled when leaks put individuals who are doing important work for this country at risk, that's a real serious problem. The flip side is when you're not being told the truth by your government, whatever, whether it's by the Department of Children and Families or DSS in your case when you wrote those great stories years ago, James Clapper lying about surveillance of Americans, or Mike Pence being put in a position where he ended up telling an untruth. I don't think it was a lie because he didn't intend it as such to the American people. Then if whistleblowers or leakers are how we get the truth, then that's how we get it.
You know, just as a quick aside, for Democrats that are listening that are very upset with Donald Trump and hope he's not going to last 4 years, remember the guy behind him is Pence, and I mentioned that because Ryan is once again talking about tax credits to replace Obamacare.
Speaking of Ryan, by the way, here's Ryan, who is, I think it's fair to say, cautious about discussing connections between Russia and the Trump campaign, saying essentially, let's leave that to the administration. We'll worry about leaks. Here's Ryan.
I understand it's reasonable and rational to try and improve relations with Russia. That's what new administrations inevitably do. But I'll leave it up to the administration to describe the circumstances surrounding what brought to this point. I think the key is this, that as soon as this person lost the president's trust, the president asked for his resignation, and that was the right thing to do.
So he's not interested in having Congress get to the bottom of what actually happened. He'll say, let's leave it to the administration to describe the circumstances that brought it to this point.
He had a brief moment during the campaign when he said, after the tape about grabbing crotches came out, where he stood up and said he was going to disassociate himself. But
he wouldn't even appear with them. Remember when the candidate was in Wisconsin?
He's quickly,
you know, who said,
and completely knuckled under.
You know who had the most courage? And by the way, he's got an axe to grind. Obviously, he hates Trump and Trump hates him because he's Lindsey Graham. That quote we played yesterday where he said, let's, you know, turn the tables. If this was Barack Obama at the end of during the transition from W, and he was paraphrase, and he was dealing behind the scenes, or his people were, with Iraq and Afghanistan, we'd be screaming bloody murder. And that's exactly
kidding?
What the deal is.
The left wing nut born in Kenya that was cavorting with all those lefty hippie, you know, would be bombers back in the 70s. I mean, are you kidding? Yeah. That was talking to the Russians. Everything would grind to a halt.
877-301-8970. So we're talking about these leaks in particular, and stepping back from leaks as a way of getting information in general. Bill, you're in Chelmsford. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey, Jim. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You talked just two points. One point I wanted to make, and then I have pose a question.
Sure.
Leaks, I think, serve a real good purpose in our government. They were a great check on some of the things that go on. But a number of years ago, Valerie Plame Wilson, I believe it was outed by the administration and exposed her as a CIA operative. And her husband was an ambassador at the time.
Right.
That really put someone's life in danger. So I think what's behind the leak, is it really a leak or is it really an attempt to harm someone?
That's good point.
That's number one.
We had her in here a couple of years ago after she wrote a great book, by the way. She really did something. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, she's a great person. The second thing is, I pose a question. Could it be, you know, we hear that the Democrats and the people who are being maligned by the Trump administration are behind all the leaks. Could it really be the Republicans? Because they would actually love to see Pence become the president of the United States. And under all of this is really, it seems such a powerful numbers of leaks coming out. How could it be that just a few disgruntled employees or people feel maligned by Trump? I really believe there's a push from the Republican establishment.
By the way, it could be, but I think, based on common sense, but yours is common sense too, that either Chuck Todd was right with us a while ago, the intelligence community was offended by General Flynn and was out to get him. My analysis, which is just thinking, not based upon anything I know that you know or don't know or that I don't know or do know, is when you liken a month or two ago, the intelligence community to Nazis,
I would suggest that ultimately one of the people who you liken to a Nazi is going to say, well, this is an appropriate opportunity to embarrass someone who thinks we're Nazis. So, I think it's payback
but
time.
It's
but
also,
your theory is as good as mine, Bill. Thanks for the
that
call.
That was a great call, Bill. But it was also some of Trump's supposedly close confidants, because we all found out about his call to the Australian guy that was practically verbatim.
Well, I think they ultimately released the transcript, as they do in those things. I don't think that was I don't know if that was a leak or
not. I think there's some leaks coming out of the White House, unless I'm mistaken.
Maybe, I think those calls, I think ultimately they released the transcripts on those things. I could be wrong, but, you know. But it wasn't that much a leak because he hung up on the Australian Prime Minister, apparently. So we really don't. 877, we don't know if he hung up. We know it was ended prior to the time that was originally assigned for the call. 877-301-8970.
John from Quincy. Hi, John.
Hello, John.
Hi there. Listen, I agree with you, Marjorie, in terms of the fact that I think the people who are putting lights to the situation who basically, if we hadn't had the leaks, we'd be left in the dark totally. And you'd be in a situation where, and if you just carry that through, then if you don't have people blowing the whistle on nefarious actions of the Trump government, then we'd never know anything. The people in the boardroom would say, well, what a great guy. And the rest of us would be saying, he's got to be screwing up somewhere, but where? And the only way you're going to know this is through leaks.
But John, what happens if the leakers disclose information that is not nefarious, that is purely intended to settle a grudge, some self-serving grudge, and it doesn't serve a useful public purpose? That's a different deal, right?
Well, I think in this situation, given what we know of Trump and his people up to now, I think we have to at least give a fair hearing to people who basically blowing the whistle. I think you're wrong on one thing, Jim. You say the leak should be investigated. I think let's investigate the original claims of the covert dealings of
that's not, but they're not my point. My point, John, was they're not mutually exclusive. I agree with you. We should definitely investigate the content, the actual connections, the actual conversations, and we should investigate the leaks too, because they're probably illegal. John, thank you. I'm not saying I don't know what punishment should be, if any, but that's, I guess, we're. I mean, a leak is in the eye of the beholder. Isn't that the bottom line? I mean, a huge part. I like to think that my stand is fairly principled, that if you're being lied. I mean, do you know who probably loved this leak, unlike Donald Trump? Mike Pence. Mike Pence went on television a Sunday. Was it Sunday a week ago? Whatever day he was on. And misrepresented the facts to the American people. My guess is if he found out about this, he'd be the first one to want the stuff leaked so that when people got to the bottom line, they didn't think it was him lying about things, but General Flynn, quote, inadvertently, what was the verb that came with it?
Inadvertently, I think inadvertently is what he said.
Inadvertently but I meant the verb that came with it. I don't know what it was. But in any case, it benefited Pence, I think, as well, because it showed he wasn't spinning the public, that in fact General Flynn was the source of the problem.
Well, General Flynn made a lot of people nervous from early on, we remember.
Yeah.
Because as somebody I think said in your show last night that, you know, it's an odd thing for someone that becomes a national security advisor to be up at rallies, a guy that was a general, a guy that's been a big leader, to be leading the locker up chants, even if you can't stand Hillary Clinton.
That was former Republican Congressman from Connecticut, Chris Shays.
Yes.
You know what else the former Republican Congressman said?
Your show, you tell
me. He went on to say essentially that, and I'm paraphrasing a little except for the end, I won't be surprised if at some point, if this continues, that Donald Trump is hearing chants of lock him up. Again, that's a former Republican congressman from Connecticut. 877-301-8970. We're discussing leaks in general and leaks in specific as relates to the events of the last, I guess, 48 or 72 hours.
Paul from North Smithfield, Rhode Island.
Hi there.
Hi, Marjorie. I'm just as anxious about all of this as you are. I mean, I've lived through Watergate, but this is worse than Watergate, because people in the highest office in our country just may be traitors. I mean, we're looking at acts of treason here.
Whoa. I got to stop you there. They may be, and they also very likely may not be. We have no evidence as of this moment that this runs up to the president. Maybe we'll get that evidence, but you would agree. I mean, those are pretty serious charges. As of this moment, there's no evidence of a Trump himself connection, correct?
That's correct, and that's okay. The reason why I think Marjorie and I are so anxious, because we really don't know. I honestly think that these whistleblowers, ironically, deserve to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of times where you see people that really put everything on the line. They know that they're probably going to get fired. They know that they could even face going to jail, and they're willing to do that. That's pretty courageous, isn't it?
I agree. And I get it back
if they're doing
Paul,
it for the right reasons, obviously.
You know, while we don't know where the connection is, I'll quote General Ryan, retired General Ryan, again last night, saying that the only explanation that he finds plausible, which I think will please Paul a minute ago, but he admits he has no proof either. Why would you keep the vice president out of the loop if the president was discussing those Flynn conversations with Flynn before he had them with the Russian ambassador? Again, there's no proof of that, but that's what the general, a former general, said.
But just not to be too much of a Pollyanna on leaks, you can also be manipulated by someone, too. If someone calls you with a leak that turns out not to be true, it turns out
to be
a spawn or something, you know, they can be trying to use the reporter to in a bad way as well. So you have to be very, very careful with them, because obviously—
Wasn't there a New York Times reporter who fell in that very trap during
Judith
the weapons
Miller
of mass destruction?
Yes.
Right.
She was leaked a lot of information, I believe, by Cheney, wasn't it?
I can't remember who it was, but I think that's exactly what the situation was there. It was there.
Yes. You know, somebody said before the show, I mean, many people aren't big fans of Dick Cheney because they think that he was the prime mover into getting us into the Iraq War. But you look at Don Cheney, you look at,
Dick Cheney,
you look at Don Rumsfeld, who was, you know, everyone loved him at the beginning of the Iraq War.
He was like a sex symbol in the cover of People magazine for a while there.
You know, you compare them to Steve Bannon and Steve Miller, the guy that was on all the talk shows last week.
And what?
Well, kind of makes you miss Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld.
Well, except Steve Bannon's never shot anybody in the face on a hunting trip. A good
That's
friend.
True.
That's a plus.
That's
for
true.
Bannon.
That's true.
Janet and Holbrook, you're on Boston Public Radio with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Bradley. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I would really like to see his taxes get leaked.
Yeah.
I can't believe they haven't been leaked, by the way. I was so sure during the campaign that, you know, Anonymous, for example, and I've had one of the founders of Anonymous on television and radio we've had here, they made commitments they were going to go after Trump, too. And I am stunned that they haven't. But, Janet, the hope for you, even though only the Democrats are calling for this now, you know that some arcane law was discovered which gives Congress the power to obtain and disclose the tax returns of private citizens, as they did for Richard Nixon and in one other case. So keep hope alive, Janet. May I get to see him yet?
Voted on that the other day, and the Republicans said no.
Well, right. So far they said no, but also Republicans were not standing up to people like Puzder a few days ago. But apparently they feel the president is more vulnerable and you can stand up to him and live to talk about it. I think there's been a sea change, or a bit of a change, at least in the last 72 hours. Thanks for the call. You know, I hope everybody on the political spectrum agrees with this, considering that every candidate for president has disclosed their taxes for, what, 4 decades?
Yeah.
For people to say now, after this Russian disclosures this week, that it would not be in the public interest to see Donald Trump's tax returns, to see if there are any dealings with Russia. And by the way, if they're not, I think it would benefit him hugely, because the inference from people like you is that's why he won't disclose the tax returns.
Well, I don't know, but it seems like a logical guess.
Yeah, I agree with you. And so if there were ever a time when you would hope there'd be a bipartisan call for a release, it is now, but it's not happening.
You know, the other thing, I mean, it's going to be a question whether people are going to choose a party over country, really. And so far, they're choosing party.
Well, some are not.
The ones that are most vociferous are the ones that have less to lose, like John McCain, who's 80.
Well, Marco Rubio actually joined the chorus yesterday asking for a bipartisan investigation.
I know.
He's a young up and – I mean, he didn't do so well in the presidential race, but he was reelected as a senator from Florida, and he's still young.
But it's kind of just kind of crazy to have all these questions swirling around what's going on here with Russia, and not to say we need full disclosure here, and for Donald Trump not to say here are my taxes, I'm the president of the United States. The voters' trust in the electoral process and the election is a big deal. People's trust in the president is a big deal. Here are my taxes. But he's not going to do it. And I think unless he starts really plummeting in the polls, I don't think enough Republicans are going to make him do it. I mean, this is kind of what's so disheartening to people. I mean, I used to say this like 10 years ago, that I always thought when the rubber hit the road, that our Congress would do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that anymore. And I think we're seeing that go on right now.
Well, yeah, again, but there's a little bit of a change. There's a little more bit my bipartisanship. The sad part is the growing very slightly bipartisanship is in response to a mess. It is not a gathering storm around something that is good, like I'll make something that makes you happy, a $1 trillion infrastructure bill that would put tens of thousands of people to work, not to mention be fabulous for the economy of the country.
He's got to get back to talking about jobs and get going on this infrastructure thing.
Did you even know? I didn't want to embarrass myself. When Chuck Todd said to us 45 minutes ago he's doing these daily job things, did you even know about it?
No. Nope.
And by the way, for those who are calling saying the reason we don't know about it is because people like you don't report it, well, one would assume if they're happening at such a rate and it's unreported, who'd be the first person to be saying every day, you're not reporting the real news?
Yeah.
Donald Trump would be saying.
Well, we all
heard
about Carrier. That was before it was inaugurated,
right,
about how the jobs were saved there. We heard about some of these auto companies that were, you know, not sending as many jobs overseas as they were. So I think people, you know, I don't think anybody wants us not to have a good economy.
You think that's the case?
I do think that's the case.
I think most people, I think it's a fairly safe statement to say that most people would like the economy.
Well,
maybe some opposition party people in the last few months.
They don't want
at the end of a presidential term, maybe you don't want things to go perfectly well, even though they'd never admit it because it hurts your cause. But I would argue when a president is starting, most elected officials probably would like to see the economy good for their constituents, regardless of
Donald
who's
Trump
in the White
announced,
House.
He tweeted today that the stock market is on its biggest run and spurt, I'm paraphrasing, in decades.
What was an exaggeration?
It's not true.
It's not true. No, but it has been.
Except for that.
Well, while it's hyperbolic,
but the market has,
been good.
The market has been good.
I have two business guys. You know, by the way, on television tonight, I want to say in advance, I have Keyser Khan, who is the Gold Star father, who spoke at the Democratic convention. I interviewed him last night. One of the most incredible 15 minutes of my life. But I also have two business leaders in this community who are going to talk about the good and the bad for the business sector. In the era of Trump.
Everybody's 401ks are doing very, very well now.
They are right now.
Let's hope they continue to do very, very well now. It just is the biggest streak in decades, even though that, as of 9 o'clock this morning, was the lead story on the Drudge Report, which drives much of the news coverage,
yes, it does.
Particularly conservative news coverage in the United States of America. Anyway, coming up after the news, Governor Charlie Baker is with us for the hour. He's going to take our questions and your questions. Our number is 877-301-8970. Our email is bpr@wgbh.org. The governor is with us. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Today at noon on Boston Public Radio, it's an hour of Governor Charlie Baker in studio to answer your questions and ours. How did the T survive the storm? Is the former healthcare executive supporting proposed healthcare cost price controls? And I'm guessing there may be a little Trump talk.
Harvard scholar and author Carolyn Light on her new book, Stand Your Ground, explaining America's love affair with lethal self-defense. Boston Globe columnist Shirley Young on the upcoming women's strike, part two, and today's immigrant strike, both to protest President Donald Trump. Plus, how to prevent Boston's South Boston Seaport District from being one big box store and mega-story luxury condo. Then we'll open the lines and ask you about that traffic jam to overdeveloped South Boston Seaport District. Is it too much to ask when you visit the Boston waterfront that you actually get to see the water? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Eastern Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey, and by the way, in a couple of minutes, Donald Trump's going to announce the new pick for Labor Secretary. As soon as he does, we will tell you who he or she is. But in the interim, we are joined, as we are every single month, to take our questions and yours, by the Governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. He's here for the February edition of Ask the Governor. You can email the Governor, bprwgbh.org. You can tweet him at BOS Public Radio or simply call him, as the full line suggests you've already done it, 877-301-8970. Governor, it's nice to see you.
Good afternoon.
Nice to see you, Governor Baker. So the good news is it's the middle of February. We really haven't had that bad of a winter, but we have had a kind of a few.
There's nobody over on the roof of that building.
Oh, there was. That's right.
That's
shoveling
a great
the
point.
Roof, right.
Yeah.
Which they were doing when I was in here that's in right. February in 2015.
That is
that's
totally
right.
There's like
wrong.
10 guys up yeah. there shoveling the roof.
Yeah. Yeah. You have a roof rake. You told us a couple
we do
years
have,
ago.
Yeah, we have a, yeah,
how's
we
that
have,
going for you, the roof rake? The house isn't leaking this year?
No, we're doing fine.
That's good. That's good. Well, the reason I say it's good because winter's getting to be almost over. But we had a pretty significant...
Do not say things
okay,
like that.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We had a
you
pretty...
You know, just... I mean, you know what happened in January of 2015. I got asked at, like, one of the first budget press conferences I had, like, a week, 10 days after we took office. And I said, here's what we're going to do to balance the current year's budget, and here's what our next year's budget looks like. And one of the reporters raised their hand and said... Do you think you have enough money in the snow and ice budget for the rest of this year? And I literally said, look outside. There's no snow on the ground. It's 45 degrees. I think we have enough money for snow and ice. So I get very nervous whenever anybody okay. says anything like that.
And then, of course, all hell broke loose. Snowmageddon.
25 out of 30 days. Yeah.
Is there a question in here?
The question
oh,
is,
good. Okay.
The question is, we have had this significant snowfall. A lot of, you know, a couple of days ago. Well, how long ago? It was about a week ago now,
whatever,
right?
Yeah.
But how did the MBTA do? What would you say the grade is for the commuter rail and the MBTA?
Well, I know that they would, they'd probably give themselves a B, and I think that's probably about right because there's always room for improvement. And they, you know, to their credit, they learned a lot from 2015, and both in terms of investing in their snow resiliency program, and also changing the way they just do business in a storm, they dramatically improved the way they operated. And I'll give you a couple simple examples. The entire above-ground third rail that powers the orange line and the red line got replaced. New heaters, better protection, concave tops so the water would run off. Much different experience. No trains sort of shorted out in between stations, which happened a lot in 2015. Second thing, the commuter rail bought really heavy-duty gas-fired heaters to put in the switches, which are, you know, the things that move the tracks at crossings. And there are lots of crossings on the commuter rail. And one of the things that happened a lot in 2015 was those crossings, you know, the switch would move and the tracks would change, and then it would fill up with snow, and then it couldn't move back, right? When it needed to move back. So they literally bought heavy-duty gas heaters to just heat the whole area inside the switch. And there are photos. The T has a lot of photos where there's snow everywhere around the tracks except inside that switch box where the track has to go back and forth. We also spent a ton of money on snow removal equipment. And I always called them snap-on plows, which made the people at the T crazy because you got to bolt them on. But we bolted dozens and dozens of plows on the front of a lot of the trains and just kept running them to keep the tracks clean. And as a result, the traction motors, which shorted out like crazy because they got snow in them in 2015, we didn't lose one traction motor in the last three storms. And so in terms of investing in the equipment and the infrastructure to support the T's operations in the snow, people did a lot of great things. The other thing they did was they created, for the first time, an emergency operations center, which puts all the key leaders around a table so that they're all literally looking at each other.
Is that the bunker? Is that something
no,
different?
They do this over at the T's headquarters.
Oh, okay.
But the point here is, when you have an emergency, and they would consider big snowstorms to be an emergency, and you want people to be able to communicate quickly and solve problems and move on to the next thing, they'd never had kind of a commitment to put everybody in the same room who makes decisions and collects incoming information and, you know, shares what's going on and then acts. And they put this emergency operations center together, and they did another smart thing, which is they said, we're going to have a rigid shift schedule here, so no one's going to be on for more than 10 hours. Because the other thing that happened in 2015 was people just got completely burnt out because they didn't have a proactive approach to managing when people were going to be in and when they weren't. And you put all those things together, and the emergency operations center worked really well. The shift scheduling worked really well. The investments in technology and in infrastructure worked really well. And while there were some bumps along the way, generally speaking, the system did pretty well. And the one other point I would make is they had a great day on the Patriot Parade Day. I mean, that was the single biggest traffic day in the history of the commuter rail. You know, they typically move about 160,000 people. They move 220, 230,000 people on the Patriot Parade Day. All the people who came into Boston to go to work, plus all the people who came in for the parade, and then all the people who were leaving to go home after the parade. And generally speaking, I think, there's plenty to do, and there will always be plenty to do. But they've made a lot of progress.
You know, if you were like I'm sure you're kind of a semi-groupie, but if you were like a total sycophantic Patriots groupie, could you, as the governor of the Commonwealth, say, I want to be on a duck boat, and they let you on?
The answer to that is yes.
But you resisted, or were you tempted?
I really wasn't all that tempted, and the main reason for that is nobody wants to see the governor on a duck boat. Okay.
Especially in a helmet. That would have been so inappropriate, Governor, if you don't mind.
That would have been really inappropriate. But, what people want to see on the duck boat is what they saw, which is the players and their families just totally sharing in the excitement of the moment. And that, you know, the governor standing up there giving, no.
Yeah, I just wondered if you got invited.
I love parades. Yeah. I love parades. I march in parades. I love the crowd. I love the vibe. I love everything about the community and all the rest with parades. But those are places where I'm supposed to be and I'm expected to be.
But you do get invited. You get invited.
Yeah. Okay. You put me on a duck boat and I'm just not where I belong.
Hey, Governor, two more quick things on the tee before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970. Are you nervous when you wake up after the debacle of 15? I'm serious. When you woke up at the first big snowstorm, two Thursdays, whatever it was ago, when you get out of bed in the morning, are you anxious about, or are you just going to work, doing your thing, and managing the best you can?
You're implying that I actually slept.
I'm serious. So what level of anxiety do you have at times like that?
A 9 out of 10.
You do? Okay. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that, actually. Go ahead.
First of all, there are a lot of people who depend on it, okay? And secondly, people have put a lot of work into fixing it. And as I said, you know, there's tons more to be done. But my view on this is really simple, which is this is something we say to people, and we have said to people for years, it's dangerous on the roads. If you can take public transportation, take public transportation. The public transportation we want people to take needs to work. And as I said, I think for the most part, people did a pretty good job. But my level of anxiety around that stuff is really high.
You know, we spoke to you a lot shortly after you took over about the privatization of parts of the team, both you and Stephanie Pollack. And these aren't your exact words, but you pretty much said we're talking about the margins, things here and there, yeah. Whether it's, you know, that nighttime service, which I know you're examining, somewhere in the neighborhood of $65 million for potential privatization of bus maintenance. That's not on the margins, is it? That's a pretty big chunk. Is that, I don't know if violative is the right word, does that run afoul of the things you said early on about how far privatization would go?
Well, keep in mind that people said the same things when we actually tested the market just to see what people would propose with respect to bus service, okay, and the cash room and the warehouse, the parts warehouse. And, you know, part of this is about literally just testing the, you know, seeing what the market will say. If you say to people, if we gave you the opportunity to provide this service, how would you provide it? How much would it cost? What would be your performance standards and all the rest? And in the case, let's take the bus stuff. In the case of the bus stuff, we got a bunch of proposals, and those proposals became sort of a framework through which we went to work negotiating with the Carmen's Union, which represents the transit drivers and the bus drivers and a bunch of other folks. And in the end, came up with a deal that, as I said in my State of the State, when I congratulated both the interim general manager, Brian Shortsleeve, and Jim O'Brien, who's the head of the Carmen's Union, it was market competitive. It's a good deal for riders. It's a good deal from a performance standard. And it's a good deal for the people who belong to the union. And they got some commitments they were looking for. We got some commitments we were looking for. But if you never go out and ask the rest of the world what they could do something for, it makes it almost impossible to figure out what it is you should try to negotiate to with your own team. And obviously our hope here is that we can have a conversation with the folks who currently do the bus service and the train service that will be based on what, you know, a market standard looks like. And by the way, there have been several studies done on how much the T spends relative to its peers on bus maintenance. And we are a gigantic outlier. I mean, 50% more than the Minneapolis bus system, public transportation system spends on theirs. And they obviously have winters that look a lot like ours.
Charlie Baker, Governor Charlie Baker, I should say, we've asked you this many times. You've been asked this tons of times since Donald Trump got elected, but we've got a lot of emails on the same subject. So I'm going to ask you again, even though you may be sick of answering the question by now. Daniel puts it in a way, why don't you join us on the right side of history when human rights are being obliterated by Donald Trump? Somebody else wants to know why you're not defending more, or not complaining more vociferously about Donald Trump's assault on immigrants, Affordable Care Act, et cetera. You want to answer that?
So my job as governor is to look out for the interests of the people of Massachusetts, sort of no matter who the who's in what position, right? That's my most fundamental responsibility, and to do, to advocate on behalf of the people of Massachusetts, to make decisions within the framework we operate in on behalf of the people of Massachusetts, to get along with and work with people I don't always agree with on other stuff, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, local officials, federal officials, state officials. And I've made very clear to my team, which is made up of Democrats, Republicans, and independents, that our job is to advocate on behalf of the people we serve and represent to the best of our ability, and to recognize that tone here matters, okay? And if you think about the way we've been able to succeed in our dealings with local officials, in our dealings with advocates, in our dealings with the state legislature, I would argue a big part of our success is we have focused on the mission and the objectives and the policy and tried very hard not to make it about the personalities. And on the Affordable Care Act, I wrote a 9-page letter. It was one of the most detailed and substantive responses that the House Majority Leader got from anybody on his ask of the governors about what works and what doesn't with respect to the Affordable Care Act. And I've now talked to a bunch of other governors whose staff and whose secretariat saw our letter about the elements of that letter, and there's a sort of a coalition forming around what we think the key elements of any kind of conversation of the Affordable Care Act needs to address and deal with and protect states from the kinds of consequences that, you know, this simple-minded language you hear in Washington would lead to. On the immigration piece, we worked very closely with the Attorney General's office on the development of her original suit, and on that one, I reached out to the Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, who happens to be from Massachusetts, and communicated directly with his office what our concerns were. After we talked to a whole bunch of folks in our community about that, and we're going to continue to advocate on behalf of the interests of the people of Massachusetts. And as I've said many times, and I've said this since before the election, in response to questions about this sort of thing, we're a global community. We are a global state. We benefit enormously, both economically and culturally, from the fact that we do have many, many different points of view, religions, ethnicities, and languages represented here. And that's a good thing.
Governor Baker, last thing before the coals on the same subject. You said, and I'm paraphrasing, if it's a little off, correct me, it's hard to believe that the reading of a letter from Coretta Scott King was out of order when...
And I took Senator Warren's side on the dispute between her and the Republican leadership in the Senate.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. There's a poll that came out, a Mass Inc. poll, that assessed how our leaders are dealing with Trump. You were seen as... appropriately 37%, not critical enough 26%, only 18% too critical. Elizabeth Warren was viewed by those same people twice as harshly on the too critical. 35% of the people in the state think she's been too critical of Donald Trump. Are you part of that 35%?
I think of my role, again, is to represent Massachusetts to the federal government and between and among state and local officials. Which means we obviously communicate with our congressional delegation as well. I try and stay in my lane on this stuff.
But is she hurting your cause? I mean, if you say your job is to deliver for the people of Massachusetts and 35% of them say Warren's been too critical, is she harming your effort, in your estimation, to do as well as again, you can with Washington?
Again, I would say this depends on what issue you're talking about. And because most people in public life get the fact that not everybody's always going to agree on every issue. She and I were on opposite sides of the Cures Act for a bunch of different reasons. And there were people in the congressional delegation who were on the same side I was on the Cures Act. But I fully expect over the course of the next several years, there's going to be a bunch of issues where it's going to require us at the congressional level, the Senate level, and at our level, to the gubernatorial level, to build bipartisan coalitions, whether it's in medical research or it's in technology or cybersecurity or a whole bunch of different areas, or the Affordable Care Act, or some of the stuff associated with transportation, where, you know, we're getting a fairly positive vibe out of Washington about some of the work we did reconsidering and redesigning the GLX project.
So you don't think that she's harming your ability to create those so-called bipartisan coalitions?
I think most people in public life get the fact that people agree on some stuff and disagree on others.
Let's go to the calls. This is the governor of the Commonwealth. He'll be with us till 1 o'clock. Let's go to Claire in Somerville. You are on the line with the governor, as in Charlie Baker. Hey there, Claire.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Good afternoon, Governor Baker.
Is my thing working?
Oh, wait a second. Turn up the volume.
Okay.
She said, good afternoon, Governor Baker, and thanks for taking her call.
Hi, Claire. Sorry. My thing wasn't
no
on
worries.
Here.
Go ahead, Claire.
So you just recently spoke about the Affordable Care Act, and you've expressed support for it as a whole in the face of a likely repeal. But I'm very concerned about the contraceptive coverage mandate because it faces an additional threat from President Trump's new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tom Price, and he could unilaterally eliminate the mandate. Access to copay free birth control is critical to my ability to control my future and support my family. So I'm wondering if you will commit to standing with Massachusetts women by ensuring we have uninterrupted access to copay free contraception, no matter how the Trump administration attacks this mandate.
I think the answer to that's a yes. And the other thing I would say about it is one of the things we stressed in our proposal to the Assistant Majority Leader, Congressman McCarthy, was flexibility for states to be able to do things that make the most sense for them based on whatever their particular circumstances are. And that's a good example of one where we would want the flexibility to be able to do what we think makes sense in Massachusetts. I also talked in the letter about the fact that Massachusetts has had an individual requirement for people to purchase coverage or take it from their employer if it's available. And I would hate to lose that because that's also a big part of how we make our plan work here in Massachusetts. And for me, the big fundamental here is ensuring that states like ours have the ability, whatever happens, to be able to do the things that make the most sense for people here in the Commonwealth. And that's a good example of one where I would hope we would have the flexibility to do what we think makes sense here.
Thank you, Claire, for the call. Margaret, you're in Weymouth. You're on Boston Public Radio with the governor of the Commonwealth. Hi, Margaret.
Hey. I wonder if you have received the 13,000 postcards from the Weymouth residents that were delivered to you on Groundhog Day at the State House.
What did they say?
I got to assume the answer to that. I'm looking at one of my teammates who's here with me who would normally know the answer to that, who's... the answer is not sure, but obviously we must have.
What did they say,
what are they about?
Margaret? All right, yeah. Each Weymouth resident, 13,000 unsigned postcard, asking you to stand with us on fighting the gas expansion in the Four River Basin.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, and you really ought to make sure you communicate those postcards to your federal representatives, because in the end, these decisions get made by the federal government. The state has a minor role to play, but in the end, if the federal government believes that certain energy capacity decisions with respect to transmission are in the national interest, it's their call. And I think and I've talked with some of the folks at the federal level about this, but that's really where these decisions get made. They don't get made at the state level.
One of our staff is just saying it's possible for you to deny certain necessarily environmental permits. Is that possible?
The feds, at the end of the day, control these decisions.
Lock, stock, and barrel.
That's right.
Charlie Baker, former healthcare executive, the Health Policy Commission is proposing, I don't know if they're rules, regulations, I don't know what they are, but there have been a lot of reports out of the Attorney General's office about these huge price variations that are unconnected to the quality of service. And they're talking about giving power, I think, to the Division of Insurance, I know you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that would allow them to cap that variation and try to address this problem that's been going on year after year. Is that something you support, and why is whatever your position, your position?
Well, this one ends up being very much the devil in the details, right? Because some of that price variation is a function of which population some of these providers serve and what their both what their patient mix is and what their payer mix is. And I don't want to get too weedy on this stuff with people, but if you're a provider who provides a lot of service to a lot of folks who are low income and a lot of folks who are senior, so that you have a big population that's primarily Medicare and Medicaid, you are in a very different place in terms of how you get reimbursed than you are if you're a provider who provides a smaller amount to Medicare and Medicaid populations and a lot of services to the commercial population.
So when all these are, but when
so my
all...
point here is that this is the sort of thing that's absolutely worth talking about. And we actually made a proposal that was certainly a cousin of the type of stuff the Health Policy Commission is talking about in our budget submission to the legislature. But this one is really, this one's all about how you do it, how it works, what level of detail, how complicated is it, and is it based on some benchmark that people can actually understand?
So you're saying if the variation is based on a justifiable fact, that's one thing. If it's not, though,
there are explainable variations and there are unexplainable
and the unexplainable, you would be open to a proposal to cap those variations.
Well, the proposal that we made in our budget had to do mostly with coverage offered to small businesses. And it was based on Medicare benchmarks, which for all intents and purposes is how everybody in healthcare keeps score. And it was a three-tiered proposal based on Medicare.
Speaking of budgets, we got a number of emails this morning from environmentalists saying that you made a commitment in 2014. You weren't governor then, were you? I guess as a campaigner, saying that 1% of your budget would go to environmental spending. And they say in these letters that somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 of half of that, a half a percentage point is going to environmental spending. If that's true, do you expect to reach the benchmark in some budget before the end of your first term?
I mean, our goal certainly is to try and get as close to it as we can. There were and this budget this year does, in fact, put some significant money into what I would describe as sort of key infrastructure issues at DEP and several other agencies in environmental affairs. The big curveball in all this, and it's not an excuse, it's just a fact, is the incredible run-up in the MassHealth program, which came about as a result, and we talked about this in our budget submission as well, that since 2013, there are about 350,000 to 400,000 people who work, and in many cases have access to coverage through their employer, who are now being covered by the MassHealth program. And that's a big departure from the way we did healthcare originally in Massachusetts. The way we did it originally was, if you had access to coverage through your employer, you couldn't go on the MassHealth program. You needed to take the coverage that was available through your employer. The Affordable Care Act broke that that structure that was in place before, and over the course of the past couple years, we've had an incredible growth in not so much the cost per recipient on the MassHealth side, but on the number of people who are enrolled in MassHealth. And that's a big issue financially for the Commonwealth overall, but it also affects things like our ability to deliver on that 1% commitment.
Sarah in Holliston, you're on with the governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. Hi, Sarah. Oops. Hi, Sarah. Hi, Sarah. Oh, that's my fault. I called. Sarah, you're now on with the governor. Hi. Start again. It was my fault. Start again, please.
Hi, all, and thank you very much for taking my call. My question for the governor and Governor Baker, thank you for taking my call. What are you doing to help the small communities like Uxbridge, Massachusetts, who are receiving construction waste from Boston onto very fragile sites that are near drinking water or over drinking water and are struggling with the DEP, who says they're new at this, as to how to regulate these sites and protect the aquifers or drinking water right under these sites? These small communities are really struggling. and they're up against some big soil brokers, and the citizens are trying to fight them or regulate them, and it's a real struggle.
So I'm not sure. Are you talking about is this the same issue that I've talked to some people about in Southbridge?
It might be a similar issue, but we have two sites, for example, in the town of Uxbridge that are receiving construction waste from construction sites in Boston where there seems to be some contamination in the waste, in the soil, and it's being brought out to locations that are right over drinking water or wells. And it seems to be unregulated, and the DEP has really been dragging their feet.
Okay, I guess, Sarah, what I would say is, since I'm not familiar with your particular situation, I would ask you to give your phone number to the producer and give us the ability to follow up with you on that and to talk to the folks in Environmental Affairs about it. Because I don't know enough about your particular issue to speak to it directly, but we can certainly follow up with you offline.
Sarah, don't go away. Hold on. Someone will take your number and transmit it to the governor's office.
We're talking with Governor Charlie Baker. He's with us till the top of the hour, taking your phone calls and our questions and emails, 877-301-8970, bpr@wgbh.org. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, and more importantly, for the next 26 minutes, the governor of the Commonwealth is making his monthly visit. You can call him directly at 877-301-8970. And do not be frustrated if you are emailing. Marjorie is furiously reading through the email, trying to identify.
Well, I don't have enough of them, but there are a few
themes. Well, the most often
mentioned
themes, exactly. That's bpr@wgbh.org.
Okay, here's a theme. I hate to have this whole conversation taken over by Donald Trump, but you were asked the other day about Donald Trump's latest claim of voter fraud when he said there were buses going over from Massachusetts to New Hampshire. I believe you said something like, ask New Hampshire. I don't know what's going on up in New Hampshire. People are asking why you could not have been more, dramatic or whatever.
If you're looking for drama, you're talking to the wrong guy in some respects, but...
Do you know about the buses rolling out of Massachusetts?
So this is the funny thing about the way media works. The guy who asked the question actually wrote down what I said. Most everybody else just picked from it. What I actually said, which is true, is I don't know anything about New Hampshire. I just don't. And it bothers me when people in public life purport to know about things they don't know about. But what I said after that was, however... We have processes in place, and I'm sure New Hampshire does too, where if you have an issue with what actually happened on Election Day with respect to the way the votes were counted and tabulated, there's always a process where you can file a complaint and pursue whatever your grievance is. And my view on that is that if somebody has a grievance with the election process anywhere, there's a mechanism in place to deal with it. Now, subsequent to that, Tom Rath, who I know quite well, who's the former attorney general who knows a lot about this issue in New Hampshire, he's sort of Mr. New Hampshire, he's Mr. Republican, and he's a big civic leader up there, came out either the next day or sometime after that and said, let me be unequivocal about this, there's no voter fraud in New Hampshire. That's all I need to know.
So you never spied new mass numbers of buses when you were walking to the State House or anything like that?
I see mass numbers of buses outside the State House in Massachusetts all the time.
Ellen Cambridge, you're on with the governor. Hi, Ellen. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Governor Baker, my call is about early education funding.
Yep.
And the budget allocates only a very small increase of 0.1% above current levels, which is not enough to keep pace with it. Inflation isn't actually a decline of 24% in real terms since 2001. Early education, as you know, is a critical support for families with young children as they enter school, throughout their school lives, into careers, and their lives as informed citizens. It's also the best education investment the state can make. Will you commit to increasing the funding for early education?
Well, I agree with you on many of the points you just made, and that's why the past 2 years we have increased funding for early education and in fact included a salary reserve in our budget submission this year, which we heard from a number of folks on the early ed side that they appreciated our doing that because it gives them the ability to advocate for that salary reserve as they begin to debate the budget in the House and in the Senate. We also chased and received a fairly significant federal grant, which made it possible for us to do some partnerships with early education providers and local school districts, mostly in gateway cities, which is where we've thought the best and most significant opportunity to deploy those funds would be. And people so far have been, and this is being studied, and people so far are coming back with some really positive responses to it. No, we totally get that in many places this can make a really big difference.
Thank you for the call.
You know, Governor Baker, I'm a big fan of Massachusetts charter schools. You were a big fan of Massachusetts charter schools. They, you know, expanding them went down in flames in November. but Bedford Mayor John Mitchell brought up, you know, this chronic complaint, and it's a legitimate complaint of the underfunding of charter schools. He claimed in one of these stories, underfunding of charter school reimbursements is up to $50 million for local districts. Is it just charter schools that don't get reimbursed? I mean, does special ed have these same problems? Or why does this seem to keep happening? Because that seems to be one of the best arguments for district schools against charter schools is they're not being funded as they should be by the state.
I'm pretty sure we level funded them in our House 1 budget submission. And obviously the legislature will decide where to take it from there. You know, in the proposal that was discussed and negotiated by the Senate last year, they reconfigured the way the charter school piece gets funded and sort of tried to take that issue off the table, the funding question. And even with that, the Mass Teachers Association came out against the proposal that was made by the Senate because they just don't want any more charter schools in Massachusetts. And I've always had a hard time separating the argument about money from the argument about charter schools. And for me, whenever I've looked at the level of funding on a per pupil basis, it's very hard to find a community where there are a number of charter schools where the level of funding for all students hasn't gone up over the period of time, last 5, 6, 7, 8 years.
Boston certainly has.
Well, Boston's
yeah.
good. Well, Boston has more charter schools than anybody.
Yeah, and the funding has gone up a lot.
So it's. I don't think that's the root of the charter school conversation. I think the root of the charter school conversation is the competition that they bring, which I think, especially in districts that aren't necessarily getting the job done for kids, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. The other thing I would say is that I respect the will of the voters on this stuff, and that's why we pledged in my state of the state to work with Representative Alice Pice in the House and Senator Eric Lesser in the Senate on this idea of innovation zones.
Yeah.
Which there's a pretty effective one working in Springfield. And my view on it at this point is that we can't quit on this idea that we need to come up with better ways to provide support for kids in communities that have had real problems giving kids the start they deserve. And the other thing I said in my State of the State is, you know, Holyoke and Lawrence and Southbridge, all of which are currently under state receivership, state takeovers, most people in those communities actually think the takeover has turned out to be a good thing for their schools. Now, whether or not you can create a model there that can be sustained over time is sort of the next question we need to figure out. But I don't think the Board of Education should be afraid to do that if they think that's going to be in the best interest of the kids of a particular community in Massachusetts.
Before we go back to the Coles, Governor, can we beat what I hope isn't the dead horse for a second? This legislative pay raise, which you vetoed and your veto was overridden. Most of the focus has been on 40% plus pay raises for the legislative leaders, Stan Rosenberg and Bob DeLeo, the House Speaker and Senate President. This story by Frank Phillips the other day on February 9th to me is enraging, and I would guess the average member of the Massachusetts public knew nothing about this. Mark Pacheco, because of some language around, he's a state senator from Taunton, because of some language about stipends, could see his salary almost double where a stipend goes up to $50,000. Mark Montigny from New Bedford, to end that paragraph, that would add $50,000 to his paycheck. They make in the 60s or low 70s. Jennifer Flanagan, Democrat from Leominster. Even if it turns out the public knew about the pay raises for the big boys, for lack of a better expression, nobody knew about this in the public. Is this essentially, I know you vetoed it, and is this, this is totally over. There's nothing that the public can do. I know it's not repealable because they included a judicial pay increase as well. This is just a done deal?
I said in 2014 when this was originally proposed that I thought it was a bad idea. And I said in 2016, once I saw the proposal, that if that made it to my desk, I would veto it for a whole bunch of reasons, including the one you just walked through. But in the end, I didn't have the numbers to sustain a veto. And I guess what I would say is that this is something people should just keep in mind as they consider their decisions in 2018.
One more dead horse or not dead horse. You and Marjorie had this discussion about these permits. We have a bunch of emails saying the denial of coastal zone management permits, apparently, which you have some control over, can overrule a decision made by FERC. Are these writers wrong?
I don't know. I'll look into it.
Okay.
I've been told by all the lawyers I've talked to that if the feds believe something's in the national interest, it's in the national interest.
Jody in Marblehead, you're on with the governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. Hi, Jody.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask the governor, first make a statement that over the last 5 years, I've been impassioned about the regulations that still permit in our state people to use mechanical devices, particularly cell phones, while they're driving, handhelds. And for about 5 years, I have tried so hard to get somebody's ears that might be able to do something about that. I have talked and written to national politicians, our local Massachusetts policy.
Jody, you don't have to you have the governor's here, so tell him what your issue is, if you would.
I could be wrong about governor. This, but I thought we passed legislation a bunch of years ago.
Nope. You did the texting. There's a Corey Atkins bill that's been pending for a while, which would ban handheld cell phones, and the arguments of people like Police Commissioner Evans is since you can't tell when someone's texting, if they're illegally texting or legally using their phone, the only way that cops would have the power to really enforce the law, and I think I'm speaking for you, Jody, and I am totally with you, is if handheld were barred as they are in, I think, 13 states and D.C., in which case there'd be no difficulty of decision-making for the police. Is that not what you're trying to say, Jody?
That is exactly right, and when you put the important aspect...
Jim Browdy's been paying attention.
It's a big issue with me.
Governor, what I originally called to ask you, please, was, is there, like in Washington, is there any kind of executive order or executive bill you could initiate? Is there any way you could have your office lobby a lot harder on Capitol Hill? The bill has been resting at Capitol Hill for over 5 years.
Well, it's resting here. Jody also asked
to get rid of cell phones?
Jody also asked if the governor would support a ban, statewide ban on handheld cell phones. Ask him that.
Yes, Governor. I guess that's the critical question. Are you in favor of that? Do you see the import of banning it?
Good question,
God,
Jody.
I hope
go
not.
I don't. When I hear from people about driving, it's about texting. I don't hear people talk that much to me about cell phones.
Yeah, but do you understand the point that he's making that I'm making?
That you, the commissioner's can't, that you can't tell the difference.
A cop, they only issued 6,000 citations last year statewide, which is like, what, 20 a day or fewer? It's because a police officer, when you see me holding my phone, I, the police officer, don't know if Jody or I are texting, which is illegal, or making a phone call, which is perfectly legal. So unless
bans handheld use
in general.
Excuse me. I just want to interject here for a second that actually the previous governor, Deval Patrick, looked in your car window when you were driving and saw that you, in fact,
were texting. It was not illegal then. But do you understand? That's unfortunately a true story.
He was texting and driving.
Okay, fine,
and
Marjorie.
Then he rear-ended this person
but you understand
on the
Southeast
Expressway.
That it's impossible for police to enforce the texting law unless handheld generally. And I guess the question Jody and I are asking is, would you support a bill like Corey Atkins, which would ban all handheld cell phone use in the car?
I tend not to take positions on legislation I'm not familiar with, and this happens to be one I'm not familiar with. I don't want to get out of the business of making it possible for people to talk to other people when they're driving, because I think the texting thing is a big problem. I'm not sure I believe that the talking thing is.
They could do it with a Bluetooth, you know, too. They don't have to hold the phone.
So now we're just going to let people who can afford to put a Bluetooth in their new car to have the ability to talk when they're in a car, but we're not going to let anybody else. Let me think about that one a little.
Fair enough. Jody, next month we'll broach the topic again. Thank you.
Jody, the thing you should... I appreciate you bringing it up. I have been under a mistaken impression with respect to how the current law works.
I hope I'm right. So we'll check, too.
Let's go back to the phones.
Where do you want to go, Marjorie?
Melissa in Walpole. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Marjorie and Jim and Governor Baker.
Hi, Melissa.
I don't have a grievance.
Oh,
nice talking to you then.
Lovely. Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
Yes. Governor Baker, as a citizen of the country and not as a lawmaker and governor of a state, are you also concerned, as a lot of us are, I think, about the hacking and the stuff going on behind the scenes at the federal level? And would you, for example, be interested? I mean, what is your feeling as a person about doing an independent investigation and trying to find out what on earth does Russia want to do with our country?
Well, I think the I think at this point there are a lot of folks in Washington, Democrats and Republicans, who are talking about some sort of congressional review and investigation around this stuff. And I think, you know, at some point, just for the integrity of the process, that's probably going to be a good idea. There's enough going on there that raises enough questions and concerns for people who, you know, basically believe in the way we do business here, that that's probably a path at this point that makes sense. The other thing I would just say is one of the reasons I've talked so much about cybersecurity and about the importance of recognizing and appreciating and understanding how important cybersecurity is to the whole interconnectedness of the world generally is because of issues like this. We have many of the most important players in the cybersecurity world in Massachusetts. We're probably, you know, on anybody's list, the top five player in the cybersecurity space. But if we are truly, not just as a nation or as a state, but as a world, if we truly want to benefit from the capabilities that will come with an increasingly interconnected world and the sort of so-called industrial internet and the ability of mechanical devices to talk to each other and to talk to caregivers and to talk to people who are patients and all the rest, we're going to have to get a lot more serious about the security issue, because every day all over the world there are state-sponsored players who are busy trying to either disrupt organizations, disrupt governments, disrupt processes, steal stuff. I mean, it's an enormous problem, and it deserves a lot more attention, in my opinion, than it's getting.
Governor, tell us about this $200 million you want for local transportation infrastructure. What's that about?
We each year we file a piece of legislation that is for local roads. And we filed $100 million and $200 million in 2015 after we took office. We filed $200 million last year, and we're filing another $200 million today. And the idea here is to hopefully get this legislation done by April so that cities and towns will be able to put that money to work during the construction season, whether it's to fix potholes that came about as a result of the winter or to use it along with our complete streets money or our small bridges money to repair bridges or to reconfigure their downtowns. This is in some respects one of the most important things we do for local communities every year, is to give them a regular investment that they can incorporate into their planning when it comes to maintaining their own infrastructure.
Well, did you get it in previous years, which would lead you to believe you'll get it again this year?
I think, yeah, we got it in previous years. Okay. I mean, the first year, we had $100 million that the previous administration hadn't released, that we released right after we took office. Then we filed a $200 million bill. Then we actually did a $30 million authorization using the same formula to deal with the fact that the winter was so bad. And, you know, there were potholes that people were driving cars into and couldn't get out. And but this is, I would call this something that's standard operating procedure until it's not. Okay, I mean, it's important that this legislation happen sometime in the next sort of 45 days or so, so that cities and towns don't miss the construction season.
Governor, speaking of transportation, Chris Dempsey was here yesterday, who you may know, obviously famous for No Boston Olympics, and now is the director, I think, as of a few weeks ago, of transportation for Massachusetts. Not a government thing. It's a private advocacy or education thing or whatever. He complimented you and Stephanie Pollack for a bunch of things you've done on transportation. But we said, if you were here, what would you ask the governor? And he said, well, I'd like to know what his vision is. And we went on to say, and so that's the first part of it, what's your vision for transportation beyond fixing what's broken, which we talked about a lot at the beginning. And secondly, he said that once you were able to staff up, and I'm paraphrasing, Marjorie, correct me if I'm wrong, there does need to be more money in the system. And I guess my second part of the question is, if you thought that it was okay, I know you're a no new tax guy, but you just announced the $2,000 per employee fee or whatever you want to call it for employers who don't provide health insurance for their people, you could obviously concoct something that wasn't a tax as such if you felt it was needed for transportation. So I guess the two parts, what is your vision as per Chris Dempsey, and can you imagine crafting something that would allow you to raise new money that would not violate your no tax pledge for transportation?
I always get a kick out of the fact that when you talk about fixing all the stuff that's broken, you don't have a vision. Yet most of the people who broke it all had a vision. I guess the first thing I would say is that my vision's pretty simple, which is public transportation matters most of all to people who can't afford a car, okay? And they need public transportation to get to work, to get to school, to get anywhere. And the fact that we don't have a modern, reliable, predictable, and dependable public transportation system for those folks is hugely unfortunate. And it's a big part of why we made the commitment to fix the MBTA and invest in its core system. You know, one of the things I'm most pleased about is almost half the bus fleet. And the buses, you know, people who ride the buses, they need to ride the buses. The people who ride the buses are going to be riding a fleet that's about half of which is under warranty as a result of a lot of new buses we've bought. And over the course of the next several years, if we put the money that we believe we will put into signals and switches and all the rest on the current infrastructure, and start to take delivery on the new Orange Line and Red Line cars, we could be able to double the capacity that we can serve on the Orange and Red Line and do it in a predictable, dependable, and reliable way. I think the and this is not just good for people who need to rely on public transportation. It's good for communities that want to bake public transportation into their economic development and downtown development strategies. We've been very aggressive about supporting communities that want to do transit-oriented development, either with land that we own or with property that private organizations own around subway stops and train stations. And we've been pretty aggressive about supporting initiatives for communities that want to do that. I think on the when you get outside the public transportation piece, my primary objective with respect to transportation is to do the things in partnership with local communities that local communities, based on whatever their character or their strategies or their objectives are going to help them serve the people in their community. You know, if you look at our small streets program or the Chapter 90 program that we just talked about or our small bridge program or what we do with MassWorks grants, all of that stuff is about collaborating with local government and saying to local government, what are the things you need to do to either develop your downtown or deal with some of your connections between what are your roads and what are our roads, and how do we go about ensuring that you have the capacity to move people the way you need to. And the other thing I would say is take advantage of new technologies. We are soon going to deliver our 10,000th ride using Uber and Lyft to people with disabilities who historically had very little options with respect to how they were going to get to school, get to the store, get to work. And if you've talked to these people who are in wheelchairs, who are blind, who have other physical or developmental disabilities, and their families about what this point-to-point service that works just like it does for everybody else and doesn't require them to map out their entire week 5 days in advance and spend 4 hours trying to get to and from wherever it is they're going. It is very powerful stuff. And, you know, I guess what I would say to boil it all down, let's start with the people who really need to rely on what the public does the most and make sure it works, okay? Second thing we should do is work with our local communities to make sure that what we do supports what they're trying to do with respect to economic development, downtown development, and livability. And then the third thing we should do is make sure that we don't chase new things before we fix the stuff we already have. I mean, one of the first conversations I had with Stephanie Pollack was I said, who's the transportation secretary for your listeners? If you were going to create a strategy around growing the ridership on public transportation, what would it be? And she and I both concluded that it wouldn't be this historical approach, which is just build a new spur somewhere and hope somebody rides it. We both agreed that the best way to do that would be to improve the quality of the current service so that people could actually rely and depend on it and wouldn't feel like they had to get in their car or get a ride from a friend or do something else. I think this... So I sort of told you what I think my vision is, but it starts with this notion that public transportation really matters to the people who rely on it, and it better work.
Okay, Governor, I have a very, very important question before you go here. You know, we have these Super Bowl bets every year where you and the governor from the other state.
So far, I have never lost.
You've never lost.
Pathetic. You know,
that's
and the only reason why I've never lost is because Governor Hickenlooper, God bless him, from Colorado, punted on... betting when the Patriots played the Broncos
last year
in the AFC Championship game. So
well,
great.
So let me ask you. You apparently, your bet was with the governor of Georgia. He bet Brunswick stew, chocolate-covered blueberries, and apple pie from some orchard in northern Georgia. So what happens? Did they ship these to the State House? Did you actually get them?
They ship them to the State House. We don't have that one yet, but I'm sure we will at some point.
What's he waiting for? Takes a while?
Whoa.
I just wondered.
I'll let you go with the big ones.
And you were also going to send him some Boston cream pie cupcakes.
No, that was only if we lost.
If you lost. But what are these Boston cream pie cupcakes from Coffee Cup? I should know about these,
in Springfield.
I guess. Really?
Yes. It's a very cool bakery. And I just love that it's a small family-owned business, couple generations. And I met him at the Big E 3 years ago. And when I made my first bet, in the first playoff game back in 2015, I said, you know what? I'm not going to pick one of the local places everybody goes. I'm going with the bakery out in Springfield.
Okay.
And so far, they're undefeated. So
you okay with that, Marguerite?
But no, I just wondered if they actually
ship
them to you.
What we do when we get the stuff is we give it to a food pantry or we give it to a shelter.
Okay. All right. So he actually sends it. I just want to check and see if they follow through.
Before we finish, I just want to remind Jim.
Yes.
And all of his listeners.
Yes,
that,
his listeners.
There are millions.
We call them our listeners.
And his viewers.
Yes.
And his viewers.
Millions more.
That I will be getting my head shaved once again to raise money for Dana-Farber in March. And Jim was kind enough to participate in this last year. We raised $4 million for Dana-Farber.
What's that guy's name who deserves
Rob
to go
Hale
to heaven? Rob
at Granite Telecommunications. He had about 800 and some odd people who... did it last year.
Including 700 or 800 of his own employees for whom he donated $5,000
apiece to Dana-Farber. Yeah, it's a great
thing.
So
what's the question?
Well, I'm going to get my head shaved, and I would love to see you join us to participate in that wonderful experience again. And I know, having talked to many of your
listeners,
your listeners and viewers, they thought you looked just great with your cut.
Well, let me tell you.
Ravishing.
First of all, I appreciate the invitation. Last night I read The Art of the Deal, so let me make this proposal.
Did you really?
No, I did not, and I don't plan to. But putting that aside for a second, last year he contributed...
I'd get in trouble if I did that.
He contributed $500,000 for you, is that correct?
Correct.
$50,000 for me.
Correct.
If he will contribute $55,000 for me this year, are you writing this down?
I am.
I will be joining you in March, and even if he doesn't, I will. It's a great, great thing. Good for him, and also, frankly, good for you. It's a great deal. It's really a wonderful cause.
The best part about it is it's a renewable opportunity.
Yes, it is.
You can do it every year, and I am glad to be able to do it.
I'm very impressed.
Thank you, Jim.
You guys are much braver than I am. Anyway, thank you very much.
Actually,
Oh, no.
Excuse me.
Oh, no.
Invite her.
No, I
could.
Invite her.
There were a lot of women.
A lot of women there
who did it. Yeah. I'm too vain, Jim. You know, vanity thy name.
Well, I'm extending the invitation from Rob Hale right now.
I don't know. Maybe in a few years.
Thanks, Governor. Good to see you.
Thank you, guys.
Anyway, that's Governor Charlie Baker. Thank you very much for coming in, Governor. He joins us every month for Ask the Governor. And we're going to give the emails and everything we didn't get to, as usual, to our producers. What do we do with the game for the producers?
Submit them to the governor's office, and the governor's office responds to each of them. And by the way, lines are full. Some of you have important questions, too. If you stay on hold, we'll take your number, and those, too, will go to the governor's
office. Okay, coming up, from muskets to machine guns, we look at the history of lethal self-defense, the subject of Caroline Light's new book. She's next on WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie. And we talk about America's gun culture and self-defense. One line of reasoning we hear a lot is the best way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
You know what a gun-free zone is to a sicko? That's bait. That's like gun-free zone. And then they walk in with whatever the hell they're carrying. I will get rid of gun-free zones on schools, and you have to. And on military bases, my first day, it gets signed, okay? My first day. There's no more gun-free zones.
The origins of our self-defense attitudes and laws, and who actually benefits from them, is the subject of Caroline Light's new book. It's called Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. She'll be at the great Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock. Caroline, it's a pleasure to meet you. Congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Caroline, thank you very much for coming in, and congratulations for doing a wonderful look at the history of this whole thing. But correct me if I'm wrong, but it's one of your major conclusions is stand your ground is about standing your ground if you're a white guy. It's not about standing your ground if you're a woman or an African-American or a person of color.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah. I conclude that in spite of a lot of language that supposes that this is a universal right to stand our ground, that in reality it's really based on very exclusionary principles that favor particular kinds of people who very often happen to be white guys with property standing their ground against criminalized others. So it actually puts the bulk of the population in serious danger.
Can you do a little bit of that? One of the interesting things about which I knew absolutely nothing is the history, how we sort of got here and why it does benefit one piece of the population. Now, give us like the Cliff Notes version of your history of this. No, I mean, really, and people hopefully will go by the book, of the history of this lethal self-defense thing.
So to try to make a long story, really long story, short, I try to trace this back to before there was a United States. I look back at English common law doctrine. I look at the Castle Doctrine, because this is something that floats around among the gun rights people, among the folks who are supporting Stand Your Ground laws, that it's about the Castle Doctrine. Well, in reality, the Castle Doctrine was the one exception in English common law to the duty to retreat. Under English common law, you were obligated to retreat to the wall behind your back if someone came after you. You weren't allowed to fight back to kill them. So that was under original English common law. The one exception was the home. A man's home is his castle. So in my story, I'm trying to unpack exactly whose castle was exempt, exactly whose castle was deemed sacred. And what I find over time, not surprisingly, is that in the context of the United States, the parameters of that castle grew and grew and grew for certain people and shrank for certain others.
You know, most of us never heard of the Castle Doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
Nor Stand Your Ground, obviously, until the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman situation.
Yes.
What's the genesis of Stand Your Ground as state legislation? Where did that all begin and why did it begin?
So the first state to pass a Stand Your Ground law was Florida in 2005. And
was that NRA woman? Was that the woman
yes.
who was? Yeah, tell that
yes,
story.
Yes, Marion Hammer.
Yeah.
And she's still out there. She was a president of the NRA at one time.
You don't mean out there. You mean she's still
around.
There. Okay,
she's
fine.
Around.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, not out there, but okay. out there ideologically. So she promoted this thing that became the Stand Your Ground law back starting in 2005, I would say. And it was promoted as a way to protect not just homeowners, but to protect all people who felt themselves subject to threat. And her particular story was very persuasive. She told the story over and over again. She is an older white woman who said that back in the 80s, she found herself pursued by a truckload full of thugs, quote unquote thugs, in a parking garage. And she, rather than back down and run away, stood up with her gun and scared them away. So she tells the story of her heroic effort to protect herself. And then she said that in most states, you're not allowed to protect yourself, that actually you have to back away, that the duty to retreat would force you to run away when someone comes after you. That is not, in fact, true. Actually, if you are under threat and you have nowhere to run and you can't get away, you are allowed to fight back. But she and gun rights supporters and the NRA framed it as if we desperately needed additional legal protection to protect ourselves. So that's how we ended up in 2005 and then shortly thereafter many other states passing.
How many states have it now, by the way?
About 33. It depends on how you look
stunned.
At it.
I was stunned by that.
Over half the states.
Yeah, that is just incredible.
I know.
And you know what the other thing that I was not stunned about, because I remember when it happened here, the case of the Framingham 8, famous case here in Massachusetts, where women who had been battered and beaten by their significant other and spouses in these women's cases, they eventually fought back, and it was became known as the Framingham 8 because they wound up in Framingham State Prison. You talk about this case I did not know about, this Pamela Smith.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened to her as well as how she has been used by gun rights advocates.
So these cases are happening all the time. I'm so glad you raised the Framingham 8. I don't talk about them in my book, but they're a great example.
Oh, my goodness. I thought
which,
I read about them right in one of these pieces.
So not in the actual book, but they're a great example, and Pam Smith as well, are examples of how women who are subject to intimate partner violence, when they try to stand their ground against their male partners, they typically end up going to prison. Marissa Alexander is another great example. Specifically, Marissa Alexander is a black woman who stood her ground. She didn't even shoot her violent spouse. She shot a warning shot and ended up going to prison in a stand your ground state. Pam Smith is from Kentucky. She's a more recent case. I believe her case was April 2016. NRA supporters, gun rights activists pointed to her as a woman who protected herself from her violent spouse with a gun. She shot him dead. Where is she now? She's in prison. The fact is that when women stand up against their male abusers, the law does not protect their right to stand their ground. And Stand Your Ground laws are not helping them at all.
But you were delving in something that is not very relevant in 2017, namely facts. It seems to me that
alternative facts.
They were really yesterday's news.
Right.
But I'm serious. When people like Wayne LaPierre, who everybody knows, the VP of something at the National Rifle Association, says things like the one thing a violent rapist deserves to face is a good woman with a gun. My guess is, despite your exhaustive research, I haven't seen polling, a huge swath of the American people, if not a majority of the American people, believe every single word he says, right?
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
If you're going to be faced with gun violence, then you should be able to counter gun violence with gun violence, right?
Right.
Self-protection. So how do you disabuse people? I mean, facts, obviously, I mean, facetiously, facts are not stories. I mean, how do you persuade people that what seems to make sense on its face, LaPierre's statement, is in fact belied by reality?
That's the million-dollar question, really, is how to persuade people that this is actually not making anybody safer. There's that ages-old mythology that a woman with a gun can fight off a rapist. But what it obfuscates is the fact that women are more often subject to sexual violence and generalized violence by people that they know, men that they know. Mm-hmm. So there's a mythology here with Wayne LaPierre and others, supporters of guns in response to gender violence, that women are most subject to threat by criminal strangers. So there's it's all wrapped up in this sense of criminal strangers that are threatening us, when in reality, women are most often threatened by their lovers, their exes, their boyfriends.
You know, in addition to the gender issues, which you raised wonderfully, some of the racial issues, or I don't remember the exact numbers, but I'm sure you do, understand your ground laws, the percentage of people, a white person who shoots a white person who's convicted, as opposed to a white person who shoots a black person. Give us those numbers, if you can.
I don't have a great head for numbers, but one of the studies says it's 11 times more likely for a white person to get off, to get acquitted for killing a black person and claiming self-defense. And part of the, and it's a very complicated story, but the bottom line is our legal system doesn't really have the space for understanding a reasonable threat through the eyes of a sort of critical look at the implicit biases of our culture. In other words, judges, juries, prosecutors don't think it's reasonable for a person of color to see a white person as a threat. But they can imagine it being reasonable for a white person to see a black person with a threat. So to see for George Zimmerman to have seen Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old black young man, as a threat to his life.
That's the voice of Carolyn Light. The book is Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. That's what I wondered if you know. Is it just the whole court system? I mean, we've everybody's Michelle Alexander's Jim Crow laws talks about the outrages in the court system. But is it just throughout? Is it the juries, the judges, and the prosecutors? It's everything.
It's the whole culture. I mean, yeah. I use the law as my text because it's something readily accessible I can look at. But as Michelle Alexander and Patricia Williams and many others have shown us, the law is a product of our culture and our history. And for me, it was important to look at the specific ways in which our history has framed the contours of lethal self-defense as something that we might celebrate as being a universal human right, but in reality, especially today, it's very selective.
And in the domestic violence cases, like the Framingham 8, is it that people think, well, why did she let him in the house?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, so with Pam Smith, that was the big question there, is that, well, she let him in the house and she had been carrying on a relationship with her estranged husband in spite of a court order. So protective orders, et cetera. But this is all classic to domestic violence. It's complicated.
Right.
Our dominant society doesn't want to see how difficult it is for women to extricate themselves from abusive relationships. Our court system, everything, it's misogyny and it's racism and classism all wrapped up into one big mess.
You know, Caroline, a couple of minutes ago, you were talking about and answering my question about the history here, about the English common law. So how do you explain that we, the United States, basing our laws on English common law and then evolving from there, have this gun culture that is unlike any others in the Western world, and England itself doesn't have a gun culture that's anywhere near what we have? Is that all Second Amendment related? But it's more than just what the Constitution says. There is a culture around it. But why didn't they derive it from their own common law and we derived it from the same common law?
I think it's a whole bunch of different things. I mean, it is about the Second Amendment, but more importantly, it's about the interpretations of the Second Amendment that have threaded through our history. It's about the specific economic structure here. I talk a lot about slavery and settler colonialism, the way in which the United States took shape specifically as an effort in Manifest Destiny for Christian European descended men to spread their ideas of civilized progress from sea to shining sea. And that's all wrapped up in this sort of package that saw it as vitally necessary for white men to go out there with their weapons and protect themselves. So this is a discourse that is woven all the way through our history. What is unique in this moment, what has produced these stand your ground laws, et cetera, is that there's a phenomenon now where it's more widespread, crosses ideological divides, where many of us are seeing ourselves as urgently in need of lethal self-defense.
You know, I just wonder if you thought much about the politics of this, because, you know, every time there's some horrible disaster, and the most horrible was, of course, the Newtown shooting of the children, people talk about, well, you know, we should maybe not have guns for people with that are mentally defective. That just got turned around by the Trump administration. Well, maybe we shouldn't have high-capacity magazines. Well, maybe we shouldn't have assault weapons. And we get absolutely nowhere, even though many members of the NRA, and correct me if I'm wrong, do think that background checks are reasonable.
Yeah.
And that some of these restrictions, like on, you know, terrorists getting guns, et cetera, are reasonable. But we're going New Hampshire now. Don't they have now that you can have a you don't need a license to have concealed carry up in New Hampshire?
They're voting on this. Yeah,
yeah.
This is called constitutional carry. There are, I believe, 12 states now that have basically you can be a civilian carrying a weapon, concealed carrying, without any training and without a license. So that's called constitutional carry. It's in, I believe, 12 states now, and New Hampshire's about to possibly join them.
Yeah, so it just seems to be I'd be nervous about going to New Hampshire if that were the
case. I know there are neighbors.
I don't want to go into the 7-Eleven and see people with guns in their waist. It would make me very nervous. But anyway, what do you see as the possibility of making any inroads? Particularly, we have a Republican president now with a Republican House and Congress. They've not been big on gun rights. Is it hopeless?
Well, okay, yes and no. I mean, I think our president was elected with tremendous monetary support from the NRA. So there's no accident, and he's not shy at all in expressing his support for unfettered gun rights. I'm very worried that the response, as you mentioned, to mass shootings, to those horrific tragedies for which the United States is known among all other peer nations, is more guns. I mean, for many people, if only there had been one of those teachers at Sandy Hook who was armed, that there would have been much less loss of life. They're wrong because more and more guns means more and more gun deaths. And all the research from experts amounts to statistics showing that more people die when there are more people with guns.
You know, one of the reasons I feel so hopeless about this, I should say, which is not a wonderful way to end a conversation with someone with all this research. One is Sandy Hook, where, you know, we all said if 20 kids and 6 adults can't do it, 26 and 7-year-olds can't do it. But we should be fair here. Barack Obama had 2 years with the Democratic Congress, and the only two gun laws that he signed into law expanded gun rights. They allowed certain carry on Amtrak. They allowed certain carry in national parks. So while I love the fact that Joe Biden ultimately tried to lead the charge with the parents of some of the parents of Sandy Hook, they were a little late to the fair, too. They can, just like with the Affordable Care Act, which they passed with no Democratic Republican votes, if this was the top priority for them, there would have been reform in the first 2 years of his administration. Maybe we'd be talking about repealing it. But the point I'm trying to make is it's a bipartisan problem.
Oh, absolutely.
Surely not just a Trumpian or a Republican problem.
Okay, Jim, I shouldn't have just blamed the Republicans.
No, it's a problem now. But I'm saying there seems to be an inability to. And, you know, when you people like John Rosenthal, who we talked to a lot to stop handgun violence, would say something like, you know, while we're obsessing on the whole country is obsessing on keeping some immigrants out who have no history since 2001 of doing us harm. How many gun deaths are there a year? 15,000, 30,000, whatever it is. It's sort of like this elephant staring us in the face. And again, as you and Marjorie said, with support for at least some modest reforms that that people just can't deal with. Having said that, I know this is not just to make you feel good for a minute. Facts are the only thing you can infuse the debate with now in the hopes that saner heads someday begin to prevail. But surely they have not prevailed.
And I think what you speak to, though, is there's a real seductive promise to this idea that if I just carry my own weapon with me, I will be safe. Not only will I be safe, but I can heroically intervene if I'm at a nightclub and somebody starts shooting or something like that, or I'm in a school.
But do you understand? I mean, I have to say, even though I would never do it only because I'd end up shooting myself.
Oh, me too.
But I understand the emotional appeal of that, particularly when you live through an Orlando or a Sandy Hook. I mean, that's the problem with that. It's not just people who are the so-called...
Well, that's what we have to push back against. Yeah. That's where my hope comes from. So I don't want to leave it with a completely, you know, on a completely demoralized note.
No, I'll just be demoralized. You don't have to be.
I'm going to try to bring just a note of optimism here, is that as I show in my book, those of us who are subject to the violence, those of us who are most at risk in this culture are in the vast majority. There are so many more of us. All we have to do is realize the extent to which this naturalized understanding of lethal self-defense as our solution to any and all security concerns and threats is harming us. And there's a body count for this ideology. So I feel like we need this wake-up call. It needs to be a bipartisan wake-up call. I feel optimistic that that can happen.
Great. Glad you do. Bye, go by the book.
Caroline, thank you very much for coming in. Caroline Light is the Director of Undergraduate Studies in the Program in Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Harvard University. Her latest book is Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. She's going to be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock. To learn more about that, go to harvard.com. Caroline Light, thank you very much.
Thanks for having
me. For coming in. Up next, with the would-be Secretary Puzder backing out as Secretary of Labor, is this a good day for the workforce or not? Business columnist Shirley Young joins for that conversation next on WGBH, Boston Public Radio, 89.7.
Is that us? I guess it is. That sort of surprised me a little, but I liked it. This is, I'm kidding. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brady and Marjorie. And so could the Seaport District become something grand like Boston's version of the High Line or Chicago's Millennium Park? Or will it end up being something grim, like a multi-season version of Boston's Winterland? That's not nice, Jim. Or a shopping destination like Legacy Place in Dedham, which is fine, too. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about the fate of the Seaport District and other business headlines is Shirley Leung. Shirley, obviously, is the business columnist for the Boston Globe. Shirley, nice to see you.
Hi.
Hello, Shirley Leung. So, as everybody knows by now, Andrew Puzder, who was going to be the Secretary of Labor, withdrew his nomination. And now we have a new gentleman, Mr. Acosta. Is it Anthony?
Alexander Acosta.
Alexander Acosta.
Oh, this is just in.
Yeah.
Yeah, a new nominee. The president is talking about it right now. So is this a good thing for the working people of America that Puzder is not there, or a bad thing?
No, it's a good thing. No one didn't like the guy. I mean, you know, from the very get-go, you know, he was not in favor of the $15 minimum wage. Women didn't like him. He had those raunchy commercials for Carl's Jr. He's the CEO of a fast food company. But what did him in was allegations of domestic violence by his ex-wife, who was, you know, there was a lot of controversy over that, whether or not, whether or not that was true or not. But then this week surfaced was this tape from Oprah.
Yeah, she went on Oprah in disguise.
Is
rather, and the Democrats were playing the video all over the Capitol Hill.
Right, right.
Ultimately, his wife did recant. Some people say.
But apparently the video was just too much. But also, I guess the undocumented housekeeper, too much for the Republicans. So both, you know, he had bipartisan opposition.
Okay. And he also, didn't he have some quote somewhere that how thrilled he'd be when he could automate all his restaurants because, you know, machines don't call in for a day
off.
He also
costed employees the worst of the worst. I mean, this is not someone that seems like a friend of labor, friend of workers. So I don't know much about the new guy. So I think
he graduated from Harvard Law School. He clerked for Judge Alito on the U.S. Court of Appeals before he was elevated to the Supreme Court. He was an assistant attorney general for civil rights in the Department of Justice. But I don't, we don't know enough.
I mean,
to
this
know
suggests that the Trump administration was ready with a backup, right?
I mean, well, I think they knew, to have, right, they saw it was coming. Right, I mean, obviously, right. He had a rough couple of, you know, the best line about this, I have to give credit to our colleague Jason here, who said, Puzder, we hearty knew ye. Now, for those who don't know, he owned Hardee's, and I wish I had stolen that line from my own, but that's a pretty good one. Yeah, that really is.
I mean, the commercials for these cheeseburgers were unbelievable, with these nearly naked women kind of crawling around with these huge cheeseburgers. I mean, the whole thing was a little bit over the top.
Yes, it was. And I mean, people are just saying, people, you know, can imagine during the congressional hearings, all they have to do is play those commercials, right? And then it would have made a real circus out of
the
hearings.
So why do you think Trump chose him? Was there a strategy to choosing him?
I think they knew it. Did they know each other?
Yeah.
And if you think about it, he kind of fits the Trump profile, right? You know, anti-worker, somewhat sexist, controversial. He was a bit of a lightning rod in the industry.
Okay, well, let's move on. You're going to write about this tomorrow, but let's start with the other one. This women's strike. What is going on with that, please?
Yeah, so, the organizers of the Women's March a few weeks ago announced that they were going to do a general strike. And this week they announced a date, March 8th. And I've just been doing a little bit reporting on this because today is also the Day Without Immigrants.
Yes.
Where, I feel like it's mostly probably felt in D.C. A lot of the restaurants in D.C., a bunch of restaurants, high-profile restaurants have closed. I mean, including, I think, all 18 locations of Sweetgreen, which is a very popular
salad
chain. And apparently two restaurants in Sweetgreen's in Boston are also decided to close in solidarity with their, because they were trying to send, the restaurateurs were trying to send a message to lawmakers that they don't like this executive order by Donald Trump that's anti-immigrant. And a lot of immigrants work in the restaurant industry and service industry.
Well, one of the restaurants, Jim, was the place we went to in D.C., where the
Comet
Spanish
Ping Pong.
Yeah, no, not Comet Ping Pong. This was the fancy restaurant that Jose Andres, the guy that was in the suit with
Donald Trump. Yes,
he was going to have the restaurant in the Trump Hotel.
Right.
But then Trump started saying these nasty things about immigrants. He said, "Forget it, I'm not working in your hotel." Mm-hmm. Trump sued him. Anyway, he closed his restaurants in solidarity with the immigrants. He's a Spanish American guy.
So my column tomorrow looks at how I've been talking to labor historians this morning and. I've never heard of this term. I mean, I'm really not that familiar with the term because we haven't had one in the U.S. of any, a general strike since 1946. And so while today's action is probably not a general strike, which is a one-day action, a walkout, but it's workers across sectors, and it's not tied to a labor agreement. It's just to make a statement. And that's what you're probably going to have with this women's general strike on March 8th, which could possibly be the first general strike of any note in the U.S. I mean, general strikes are tools in other countries. I mean, you find them very common in Europe and in Latin America, but not here in America.
What are they, you know, I have to say, I didn't know much about this Day Without Women thing, with no women for March 8th. What is, of course, the size of the rally snuck up on virtually all of us, too.
Yeah.
And we're well beyond expectations.
Never be as big.
Well, what's the early line? We're close. We're not that far from March 8th.
No,
and a lot of women were really emboldened, including women who are not demonstrators in general.
Right.
Were really emboldened by the colossal turnout of this thing.
Right. And so this is more, the organizers haven't released any really details except for the date now. But in other countries, I mean, you just call workers across, don't come to work that day. And the idea is not necessary to cause economic harm. It's just to make a statement. So hopefully by flagging the date, gives people some time to organize, to be like, I'll take a vacation day that day or whatever. It won't be it'll be a day in which women and hopefully men, too, will make a statement.
Do we have any sense? I know you mentioned that Washington, D.C. is where a lot of this immigrant strike is centered. But do we have any sense whether it's been big or significant?
I mean, that's what I you know what that's what we're reporting right now. I mean, there are
we don't know yet.
I mean, that's what's kind of being reported now. I mean, I feel like it was kind of hastily pulled together. I mean, I didn't really know about it until the last 24 hours. But you know, there is supposed to be, I think, another day without immigrants on May 1st, and I think that could be another general strike situation. You might remember about 10 years ago there was another day without immigrants. I think 2 million people participated across the country,
really?
Largely probably in L.A., but people in businesses and schools walked out for a one-day demonstration. This is at a time when there was some anti-immigration legislation coursing through Congress.
And so what was this?
2006. It was called the Great American Boycott, or the Day Without Immigrants. And I think immigrant advocacy groups are trying to organize another one for May 1st.
It was Shirley Lang for the Boston Globe. You wrote a great column about the Seaport District searching for its soul, and talked a lot. And I remember this. We pulled this because I remember this piece by Robert Campbell, your architecture critic, from 3 years ago, basically trashing the Seaport District. It said it's like ugly and it's not coordinated. So now you get down there, and there's always a massive traffic jam, and there's a lot of big boxy things. It's on the water,
right. But
you don't really get much. Get that little walkway behind all the restaurants,
right. But
there's not much opportunity to get close to the water down there. I'm not an architecture critic, but to me, it's just not. It's kind of slapdash and thrown together.
Yeah. A lot of the criticism. So I wrote this week about something called Seaport Square, and I call it kind of our really last chance, really the make or break piece of property or massive development in the Seaport Square. It's about halfway done. It was formerly owned by Frank McCourt.
Yes.
Long ago.
It should be parking lots, right?
Parking lots, and part of it is being built now between Northern Ave and Seaport Boulevard, and it's going to go and then it kind of creates an L and goes along to Summer Street. And the new owners of this, it's changed hands quite a bit. The new owners are WS Development in Chestnut Hill. And their really most high-profile projects have been in the suburbs. They designed Legacy Place, the Derby Street Shops in Hingham. So now they're really tackling urban development. But they're really retail specialists.
This is the street, too, right?
The street,
in Chestnut Hill?
Right, the street.
Yeah.
That's where their headquarters are
now.
And so you could see that I met with Dick Marks, one of the partners. You could see he feels the pressure to get this Seaport Square right because it's so critical. I mean, as I wrote about it, it's really an inflection point for the Seaport District. You know, this is an opportunity. Will this one project, 23 acres, quite large, it'll perhaps, you know, be the difference between the Seaport District being another financial district or the Back Bay, and they feel the pressure. I mean, they have proposed this what they call the Harbor Way, and this linear park. They hired one of the architects behind the High Line in New York,
which is fantastic.
Elevated railway, and it's become a public park. And so they want to do a very similar linear park from Summer Street all the way to Fan Pier. They're trying to get Joe Fallon, who owns Fan Pier, to connect. You know, to also create some space on his property so that you can walk from Summer all the way to the water and connect with the Harbor Walk. And it's a very ambitious plan. But, you know, already the neighbors are quite upset because, you know, in doing this park, they've gotten rid of a giant square. There's supposed to be a big green public park in the middle of Seaport Square, and they've gotten rid of that to do the linear. And also, the other thing that's quite controversial is that in the original planning zone, I don't know what you would call that, but there was a proposal for a 200,000 square foot performing arts center, and they said it was more like a recommendation, not a requirement, and so they've basically taken that off the table.
Okay, let me ask you a stupid question. I think Marty Walsh renamed it. Used to be the BRA, the Boston Redevelopment Authority.
Yeah.
Named it something else.
Boston Planning and Development Agency.
Yeah, isn't there supposedly somebody that's supposed to be kind of in charge
Amen.
Of this stuff?
That's my question.
So we don't have all this stuff just like getting thrown out there.
Yeah. And you're not totally dependent
dependent on a private developer for what the city looks like. I don't get that either.
You know, I know we're not New York City, but you go down like the High Line you just mentioned, which if people haven't been to it, it is unbelievable. In the nice weather, I wouldn't want to go there today. Yeah. But you know, they have all these gorgeous plantings, right. And you're looking out these really cool apartments, and you're looking at the water, and you're looking up and down through Manhattan, you know, through Chelsea, which I guess is where it is. You get that beautiful new Whitney Museum that's there. I mean, it's just spectacular. We are on the water right down there in the Seaport District. It kind of breaks your heart how when you get down there, it's just sort of like a mess.
Right. I mean, the city has planning officials and in charge of this. And what struck me in my conversations with them, I said, why aren't you? I feel like you're letting the developer dictate the terms. You know, I was thinking about more after I wrote the story. One of the reasons why this 200,000 square foot performing arts center got jettisoned is because the developer said no one stepped forward and said, I want to build this, you know, multi-story performing arts center. They didn't think the demand was there. And so let's say the demand isn't there, but it seems like the city should hold the developer's feet to the fire and be like, okay, you can't do 200,000, but do 100,000. Or if you can't do 200,000, then, you know, do 50,000 art and then the balance go back to becoming public space. It seems like there's got to be a better deal for the community. I mean, this is an area that's starving for things that make a neighborhood, like maybe a school or a library. They need more civic activities down there because there's a lot of office spaces. I mean, what's really amazing about this project is that in taking away the cultural center, and they are building this you know, kind of Boston's version of Highland, but at the same time, they've significantly increased the amount of office there and also residential units. It's by 17%. So it's become an even bigger project.
Can I a variation on Marjorie's question? I'd like official process if it's good, but what I never understand in situations like this, and by the way, thank goodness for you, and is it the Bar Foundation? Is that what it's called?
Bar Foundation, but there's a community activist,
right,
as well.
Who are shining light on this thing, or else nothing would happen, I would assume. I never understood whether it's, what's another good example? The mess at Suffolk, this thing. If a Marty Walsh or a Marty Walsh and Charlie Baker call a bunch of boys and girls into a room and say, this is the way they want, I don't mean in a nefarious way, by the way, but say, we think this is what's best for our city and our state, and we'd like to work with you to get from here to there. It's almost impossible to say no. And so but that's not done. Am I wrong? I mean, they did it for GE, by the way. They met in the North End. Right. It was cataloged. Right. I mean, were it not for these private backdoor kinds of resolutions or dealings, we probably wouldn't end up with GE down there. So why aren't similar sorts of sit downs done so that we don't have to cross our fingers and hope we'll never get to see the water again down there?
I do think there are a lot of conversations between the city and developers, I found myself in the same situation. I'm looking through the documents that were filed, and they look fantastic. The renderings look amazing. And so it's kind of hard. You almost have to kind of draw a line in the sand and kind of really champion certain things. And I don't think that's happening enough at City Hall. It's like, we are going to champion open space. We're going to champion civic centers.
Do they care about
district.
I mean, do they? I don't mean this harshly. Is the bottom line the bottom line? It's sort of like the shadow thing that you and Marjorie have discussed ad nauseum.
Yeah.
It's like $150 million, which is very appealing. I don't even mean this critically. They decide, well, the money for important services is our bottom line, even if the planning is imperfect.
I don't know what's going on, because I feel like the City Hall could push harder. I feel like they're in the driver's seat. They've got leverage. This is the hottest district, one of the hottest neighborhoods in America. I feel that the city should feel like it could call the shots, not the developers. So I don't know, but something's being told, because it seems like every time there is an ambitious plan, it changes. Though I have to say, the city did back off the Harbor Garage. I mean, mm-hmm. they instead of 30% open space, they went back down to the state requirement, 50% open space. So they did listen and react, but it's a little bit of a delayed reaction. Now, this Seaport Square today begins the first of a series of public meetings. So this could go on for months. So there is still time to really shape the project. And I think the developers are open to it. I think they want
I didn't
even
mean to be critical of them. I just meant you'd like to see direction from the top, I guess.
You would.
Well, it's just such an, it always made me sad, even though the federal courthouse is a spectacular building. If people haven't been there, it's a spectacular building.
It's an outrage.
But the problem is it takes up all the waterfront. So you, as a regular person, can't get near it.
It's a great location for the judges. It's not a great location for real
people.
But
you can go in there as a real person? I'm not sure.
But it was there back when nobody wanted to build. So it was built there as a catalyst, an economic development catalyst.
Courthouse has to be on the water?
But think about back then, nobody wanted to be down there. You know, there were just a bunch of parking lots.
It's so weird down there. You know, you go down there and you park your car. We were all down there for different trials. Whitey Bulger, Sinaia trial, whatever it was, you're all down there. And then you come back 6 months later. The parking lots are all gone. It's so amazing. Weird. What happened to the parking lots? It's been developed so fast. One last thing, though, before you go. We did learn that GE apparently has given up on their helicopter pad. So yes. I guess that will ease a lot of the neighbors. You don't have to worry about helicopters coming in and out of there, right?
I've said all along, I don't know why they put this into their proposal. Because where they are in Fort
very
Point is very close
Logan.
To the airport.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
But
so
I thought it was a central part of the deal. Wasn't it really important?
Well, because think about it. They used to live in Fairfield, Connecticut. Their CEO and top executives travel by helicopter to their training center in New York or Manhattan. It is part of daily life.
Is this the recluse, the woodsy recluse that you guys wrote about the other
day
in the Globe? Oh, that was unbelievable. where you can go like and spend a week in a cabin,
right.
You know, working on your management skills or something,
realize,
and have a cocktail
right.
hour and games.
right.
I mean, what a deal
right.
that is.
So they didn't realize how close Logan was. But the thing is that John Barrows, the economics czar from Boston, said the helipad might not be completely off the table because in GE just raising the issue, we'd like a helipad, other companies have stepped forward. It's like, yeah, I think a helipad is a good idea. So I don't think this is the end of the helipad story.
Okay. We should take some bets. Will we end up with a nice walkway on the waterfront down there, or will we end up with seven helipads?
I wish everybody listening had seen the High Line. I mean, been there. I mean, it really is
the
High Line,
like a life-changing
kind of thing.
My jaw was open.
No,
the gorgeous, the plantings and the benches, and they have the outdoor ice cream places and the outdoor coffee places. And
it's a relatively new park. Yeah. It's only a 2009, and it's one of the biggest tourist attractions in New York City now.
No, it's really exciting. You don't like to be outdone all the time by New York, even though I realize that they're bigger, and if you make it there, you can make it anywhere, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, Shirley Leung, thank you very much. Shirley Leung joins us every week. She's a business columnist for the Boston Globe. Coming up,
well, we're not sure.
We'll
Donald
see.
Trump has been doing a press conference while we're talking to Shirley Leung, and I was monitoring it while they were doing it, and he and Jim Acosta from CNN got into it again about fake news. The president of the United States says that no one talked to in his campaign, talked to the Russians, that it's, quote, a joke. Fake news is all over the place. The media's, quote, tone is such hatred. We're going to have to catch up quickly, but my guess is that we're going to discuss that with you for the remaining minutes in the show. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As we were speaking at about 12:40, quite a while ago, the president announced his replacement nominee for the Secretary of Labor, Alexander Acosta, about whom we don't know a lot. I told you pretty much all we knew. He was at the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, for a while, dean of a law school in Florida, clerk for Judge Alito before he was on the Supreme Court, when he was on the Court of Appeals. But then he opened up questions, and he took questions from reporters who were not only from conservative outlets. The primary theme of this, it seems to be, is yet another attack on fake news. The media's, quote, tone
is such hatred. The public doesn't, quote, believe you anymore. Here he is talking about the New York Times story that had not been contradicted from anybody in the administration until now, describing the reports of those connections by people who were connected to his campaign in 2016 as fake news. Here's a little bit of that.
And, you know, you can talk all you want about Russia, which was all a, you know, fake news fabricated deal to try and make up for the loss of the Democrats, and the press plays right into it. In fact, I saw a couple of the people that were supposedly involved with all of this, but they know nothing about it. They weren't in Russia. They never made a phone call to Russia. They never received a phone call. It's all fake news. It's all fake news.
And he also condemned yet again the leaks of conversations that his former national security advisor, General Flynn, had. Here he is on that.
I just want to get you to clarify, because it's a very important point. Can you say definitively that nobody on your campaign had any contacts with the Russians during the campaign? And on the leaks, is it fake news or are these real leaks?
Well, the leaks are real. You're the one that wrote about them and reported them. I mean, the leaks are real. You know what they said. You saw it. And the leaks are absolutely real. The news is fake because so much of the news is fake. So,
and he goes on and on. Essentially, this is a fairly long assault on the media's reporting on the Russian connection, on the media in general. And Marjorie and I were just talking during the break here, and we only have a few minutes left at 877-301-8970. Has this constant assault on the media by Donald Trump, which we know is quite popular with some, has it caused you to trust the media more, the perpetrators or the purveyors of so-called fake news, as Donald Trump would call it, or has it caused you to trust them less? What's the impact? I mean, I saw a poll about a week or two ago, and a majority of the American people had more faith in the media than they did media's criticism of Donald Trump than they did Donald Trump's criticism of the media. But my assumption is he would not have done what he did today unless his sense was that categorically denying that any of these contacts happen and stating that it was fake news yet again is a conscious decision that they believe will get them where they want to be. Blame it on the media. And we want to know, what effect has this had on you vis-a-vis your relationship with and trust in the media in this country? 877-301-8970. If you want to weigh in on this, you got to do it fairly quickly because we don't have much time. By the way, on Jim Acosta, who you remember, he got that into that big thing with not so long ago. After telling him a couple times today to sit down on Acosta, he said, go back and check the family tree, check that out, to make sure that Jim, this was a joke, by the way, to make sure that Jim Acosta was not related to Alexander Acosta, who he had just picked as Secretary of State. And then Acosta, from what I could see, was trying to defend CNN against the charges of fake news. And that's the point at which he was told to sit down, and all these kinds of things. 877-301-8970. But I'm really curious to know what impact it's having on people's perception of the value and credibility of the media in this country.
Well, there were a lot of other odd statements made
like at
this press conference. I don't think there's ever been a president in this short period of time that's done what we've done. I mean, I suppose you could say that's true because no one has done an immigration ban like he has done, and had this Russia thing that I
Well, there is not an immigration ban. There's not.
Well, attempted to do an immigration ban. He says the administration's running like a fine-tuned machine. He went back to talk about his electoral college win, and he does say, and this could be true, and I hope it's true, that some things will be announced next week. But, you know, it's hard for me. I don't know how other people feel, but it's hard for me to believe him because he seems to be living in an alternative universe.
Let's focus on the media. If we only have a few minutes left, let's focus on this: how this attacks the constant assault on the media and the media fighting back to a degree, what impact it's having on your perception, actually, of both. Let's start with Stephen in Abington. We don't have a huge amount of time. Stephen, thank you for your call. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to throw it out there that it's while it's very important for us to scrutinize all of what Trump is up to, as the investigative journalists that we have in our midst are even more important than ever before in finding the truth here, because what is most dangerous about this particular individual is that is what he's doing, not so much what he's saying. And I think it's extremely important that we keep an eye on what's going on in the background.
But Stephen, I know you're not a pollster or a guy who does survey groups. When the President of the United States stands up, and everybody's going to see it tonight on the evening news or if they're watching now, and says essentially, you're all liars. You're all, again, purveyors of fake news. What impact do you think that has on the average person who is not following this 24/7, like Marjorie is, for example? What impact does that have on the average person in the Rust Belt, for example, where he did quite well? What do you think?
I think it's extremely dangerous because they believed in him enough to vote for him. And now many of them, and most of them, I would imagine, who did vote for him, will continue to believe in him. And it's extremely dangerous if we have nobody to report the truth, or the truth isn't apparently coming through to us. Well, then we're in a very, very dangerous place. He's an extremely dangerous person.
Stephen, thank you for calling. Well, appreciate it.
One of the things that is hopeful is that since his election, that the subscriptions for the New York Times, Washington Post, as we learned yesterday from Brian McGroy from the Boston Globe, have increased dramatically. I think the New York Times saw one of its biggest increases ever. Yes, in a short period of time. So there seems to be this huge urge to go out and read these purveyors.
But are these usual suspects? What I don't understand is, are people who were trusting the media before now depending on it and trusting it more, and those who didn't now don't even more emphatically? Or are some people, this is what I don't know, are some people being moved? I mean, he is the President of the United States,
right,
by the President of the United States relentlessly saying how you can't trust these people. Nobody trusts them. It's all fake news. I mean, he basically said just now that the New York Times story, which I had not heard contradicted by anybody, by the way, other than saying leaks are the issue, not this, he says it's just not true. There was no contact between members of his entourage and the Russians at all.
And Michael Flynn is fine.
Yeah.
And he's done really well. And he was
he didn't like the way
guy.
He handled it, but he's a wonderful person.
Yeah, I guess maybe if you are dyed in the wool with Donald Trump, maybe you do believe him. I find it hard to believe how you could. We just talked about this with Governor Baker about the busloads of people from Massachusetts going up to New Hampshire that the president talked about earlier this week. Do people believe that?
I don't know. And so here's a little bit of Donald Trump's exchange with CNN's reporter, the second one of this sort, with Jim Acosta.
I would be your biggest fan in the world if you treated me right. Now, I sort of understand there's a certain bias, maybe by Jeff or somebody, whatever reason.
He's talking about Jeff Zucker, who runs CNN. You know, it just... Pamela, you're on Cape Cod. We're really short on time. Thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
We can. Yep.
I just don't understand why the media isn't saying right back, but the news, the New York Times, is telling the truth.
Well, that's what Jim Acosta was.
Trash the media. We should be telling him right to his face, you are lying.
Well, I don't think a reporter should be saying you are lying. I guess Dan Rather tried that once with Richard Nixon, I believe. But they are challenging him. That's why he and Acosta got into it. I think they're challenging a president in a way that in my lifetime, Pamela, I have never seen. I've never seen anchors, responsible ones I'm talking about, whether they're conservative or liberal. I've never seen anchors challenge like this and question like this. I've never seen reporters, legitimate reporters, do this. But again, we didn't see this. We are not listening to it live. We're reading about it. But it sounds like a lot of these reporters are doing exactly what you want them to do. And I hope most Americans want them to do as well. Pamela, thanks for the call.
Well, I give him this much. He's taking all the questions. He's been on the stage behind the podium there for quite some time. So
by the way,
engaging.
You guys in the control room, on that note, he did announce Acosta's nomination shortly after 12:30. So he's been doing answering questions for more than an hour, essentially. Came in closer one. So almost an hour after the announcement he's taking. And by the way, let me tell you, my attitude is you're entitled to the truth, but at minimum, you're entitled to access and not just conservative news outlets like the last two press availabilities he did. So the fact that he's there, good. And obviously, we're going to talk a lot more about it tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tonight, please join us if you can for our Cinema Classic Challenge. We're taking it on the road. We're going to be at the Somerville Theater tonight at 7 o'clock for the screening of the 1973 sci-fi classic Westworld. And then tomorrow, we're going to take your calls asking you if it still holds up. And if you're in the Back Bay, we'll be at the library tomorrow tomorrow. That's the Boston Public Library, corner of Boylston and Exeter Street. We'd love to see you there, right next to the Copley Tea Stop. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Teresky, Molly Boygon. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. We are a production of WGBH. What's on TV, Jim?
We're going to talk about Trump and with a couple of CEOs. Muhammad Ali, yes, a different Muhammad Ali, is president and CEO of Carbonite, a Harvard business professor about the good and bad of Donald Trump for business. But most importantly, whether you liked what he said or not, I really recommend you listen to Khizr Khan tonight. He's the Gold Star father who spoke at the Democratic National Convention. And again, even if you don't buy his message, if you have a son or a daughter, you really have to listen to what he had to say about his son tonight on Greater Boston. I spoke to him last night at the Kennedy School.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a wonderful afternoon.